It's time for Windows Weekly. Paul Thurrott's here. Richard Campbell's here. They're going to talk a little bit about Apple's WWDC keynote, the Vision Pro headset, and some interesting news for Windows gamers who use Macs. Plus, the end of the line for Cortana. And Paul says 3 months without an Xbox. His final report coming up next.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Windows Weekly with Paul Thurrott and Richard Campbell. Episode 832, recorded Wednesday, June 7th, 2023. Saturated by fake girlfriends. This episode of Windows Weekly is brought to you by the AWS Insiders Podcast. Search for AWS Insiders in your podcast player or visit cloudfix.oria.com/podcast. And we'll include a link in the show notes as well. And thanks to AWS Insiders for their support. And by Cisco Meraki, with employees working in different locations, providing a unified work experience seems about as easy as herding cats. How do you rein in so many moving parts? I'll tell you how. The Meraki Cloud Managed Network. Learn how your organization can make hybrid work work. Visit meraki.cisco.com/twit. And by Melissa. More than 10,000 clients worldwide rely on Melissa for full-spectrum data quality and ID verification software. Make sure your customer contact data is up to date. Get started today with 1,000 records cleaned for free at melissa.com/twit. It's time for Windows Weekly, the show where we get together and have a good time with Mr. Richard Campbell of Run As Radio fame and .NET Rocks. Hello, Richard from Coquitlam.
Hi there, friend.
On the edge,
good to be at home.
On the edge of disaster, but still with us.
We're okay.
Yeah. Mr. Paul Thurrott, who is in, of course, Macungie, Pennsylvania, and is under a cloud right now, thanks to Ontario, Thurrott.com and leanpub.com. Hello, you two. Hello, guys.
Hi. Our neighbor asked us yesterday if there was a fire nearby, and I said, yes, all of Canada is on fire.
Canada is burning. Our hearts go out, and especially those of us up here in Northern California who will soon be, I have every reason to believe, in the same boat. Golly, this pollution's really getting to me.
You know, it's crisp and clean and clear in Mexico City. And here it's dirty and polluted.
Because Mexico City's notorious for being one of the most polluted cities in the world. So just shows you. Just shows you.
Well, that's a little out of date.
Is it? It's clean now?
Yeah.
They clean.
I wouldn't say it's clean. It's like a big city. Yeah. But they've addressed it.
Emission controls help quite a bit.
They just stop reporting it.
There you go.
It's Mexico.
If you turn off all the sensors, the numbers are great.
Yep.
So I'm going to assume, I shouldn't assume, but I'm going to assume that today this show is going to be all about Apple.
Thank you. It is.
Is it? No, I was kidding.
No.
I was joking.
No, it's not going to be all about Apple. But I think we should, let's just talk about this a little bit, because not about Apple's. We're not going to run down Apple's announcements or anything like that. But
no, we did that for three freaking hours yesterday on MacBreak Weekly.
Yeah,
you're off the hook.
Yeah. Don't worry about that. No, but I think this is a more interesting discussion to be had. I think you guys, can you hear that? Or is this just in my brain?
No.
Because they're banging on my ceiling.
That's fine.
All right. So
I like your coinage that this is developer conference season.
Yeah.
I think that's true, isn't it?
Right. Google I.O., Microsoft Build, and then Apple WWDC always kind of wraps it up. And it's a May, June, early June kind of a thing. It's very interesting to me to compare the presentations, right? The announcements, the things that they highlight, but also the way that they address their respective developer audiences, right? And this is not exactly deep insight, but it is interesting to me that Apple's approach to developers is exactly what its approach to consumers is, which is you get everything from us. You get one version of everything. You use that. Whereas
welcome
Google
to the
and
walled
Microsoft,
garden.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's, you know.
There's something to be said for that, I'll be honest, right?
Yeah. Actually, you know what? The reason I wrote this article was because I watched the developer keynote. Like, all of these companies have a separate, well, not Microsoft. So Google and Apple both have a separate developer keynote, right? Apple calls it the platform state of the union. And literally within the first 60 or 90 seconds, the guy, whoever he is, I've never heard of him, but he described platforms as a combination of a language, frameworks, tools, and services, .. And I paused it. And I went back and I said, did he just say a language? And literally he did, because Apple has a language, Swift. And I thought that's really interesting, because that's
because they're trying to put Objective-C behind them. Right.
Well, yeah. Right. Obviously, they had a language before, and now they moved everyone. They're trying to move everyone to this new language.
It's not
they
really, have really fair to say a language, because you can develop for Macs and many languages, but
you can. But from Apple,
Swift,
right?
No, but I mean, even Xcode supports Python and Lisp. No, I, and
of course, but nobody's creating an iOS app in Python. You know, like it's their tools are all based around this one thing. Yeah. You could, but they don't.
And look at Flutter. I mean, this is
no. Apple. That's part of the story. That's actually part of my point. So, Flutter, Google is very much like Microsoft. They're in the same kind of boat. They have their native tools, native languages, native frameworks, native whatever. But they also have this cross-platform stuff, you know. Google and Microsoft are curiously identical in this regard. They don't care how you do it. They just want you to do it. Mm-hmm. They want you to target multiple audiences. Apple desperately wants you to only target their platforms.
They tried this with the iPhone back in the day, right? I mean, that was the great threat to Xamarin and PhoneGap and them. That's when they said, hey, if you haven't built it with Apple tools, we can't allow it in the store.
Right.
And they put that policy out there and then never enforced it.
Yeah.
And it just sort of quietly went away, because it turns out that may have been a line too far even for Apple.
It's a dumb thing to do. Yeah. Yeah.
It's a terribly dumb thing to do. But then again, Apple, you know, has been ignoring PWAs for years.
But Apple's using the carrot, not the stick. What they're really doing is saying, look, we'll give you all the tools for free. They've even, you know, got a free developer account now that lets you use developer betas. So you really, you're not even, you know, you can really do.
That's brand new, though, by the way.
It was
$99 a year until yesterday.
They still have $99. But you could do a lot. And you always get Xcode for free, and you can always get the developer tools for free. And that's the carrot, Apple's, right? You don't have to use Flutter, but why would you when you've got Xcode, right?
Oh, because Xcode is terrible. And Xcode only runs on a Mac, right? I mean, it literally extends to, like, you have to buy their product to develop software using their tools that write to their frameworks and target their devices. That's how Apple wants that development.
The way Apple defines platform, which, by the way, you can contrast directly to what Microsoft said and build. But the way Apple defines platform, there is no cross-platform. That makes no sense.
There is no cross.
Nothing to them.
Exactly. Yeah. Right.
I mean, that being said, they did include Unity in the list.
I'm sorry, they did what?
They include Unity because Unity is the engine for the Vision Pro.
So, yeah, but guys, listen, I don't have to explain to you guys how Apple works, right? We need you until we don't need you.
Right.
You know, what's one of the only things missing on the Mac platform? A good game story. Well, how do we get that going? Well, I guess we're going to partner for a little while.
Well,
the eventual goal is
Epic's Unreal Engine, right?
Yeah, well.
Bye-bye. But they have to have something. Yeah. And Unity, Apple is really all in on Unity, as you said, until they're not.
And I think they need to be. It's not the language. It's not even the platform. It's the 3D assets. Yeah. Unity's stack of 3D assets is bar none. And that's what you're going to need if you're going to
even Apple can't ignore it as well.
You can't avoid this. Yeah. They did put it at the bottom of the list. Like, I'm scrolling for a while before you finally got to – okay, so, Unity.
I should point out, in the keynote, it was very much a part of the Vision Pro discussion. They said it in the keynote, which means it was a lot of things are very
well. It kind of makes that platform viable and interesting.
Yeah, they want you to use Unity. That's for sure.
If you as a $3,500 headset doesn't address what the $350 Meta thing does.
Right.
You just look stupid.
You have to.
Right. So they
have to.
They had to do
that.
I agree. I didn't see anybody making comparisons to HoloLens with this at all.
Oh, I was. Always I spent, to the Quest. That was my whole.
We did.
Because
we did. Of course.
And this is part of the thing I want to move on to in a second. Yeah. But let me step back real quick, because the one thing I just wanted to communicate about the Apple approach versus Google, Microsoft is very interesting, because Apple for developers, just like Apple for customers, is pushing simplicity, right? Just accept the warm embrace of Apple and everything's going to be great, you know? Mm-hmm. Whereas Microsoft and Google are like, you have a million choices, do whatever you want. You know, it's an interesting thing. It literally is like simplicity versus choice. It's fascinating to me that this extends.
The definition of platforms that Microsoft used, which is a platform is something that the people who develop upon it make more money than the platform developer. Apple would never say that.
That's sure. I mean, I think that's Bill Gates' reference to ecosystems.
Yeah. Apple says, we make the most money in the ecosystem. We're glad to share billions of dollars with our developers. They always talk
about that.
But they're a trillion, $2 trillion, almost.
We'll share until we want a feature that you're making in your own app, and then we'll just steal it.
And then we'll kill
you. But yes, they're a wonderful company. But
from the user's point of view, I think that's not a bad argument. I mean, the user says, great, it's very clear. You know, I know, I don't have to think.
Yeah, it's simple.
And if you're a developer, you know, people develop for Twitter. People develop for Reddit. People develop for Meta and YouTube. They know they're building on somebody's platform and a rug that could be yanked away at any time, but there's enough money there to make it, well, I'll take my chances.
I'm kind of stunned they didn't show off an app of any kind. Like they just showed the desktop and talked about stuff. Like they didn't know launch app. Like I'm just staggered by that.
Well, you know what else? They never showed any executive from Apple, any personnel from Apple wearing it.
Well, by the way, the top executive wears glasses, and that awkward doesn't work. You know,
no, but you can put lenses in. They would have Tim Cook.
No, I understand what you do, but I'm just saying you don't want to do the live demo with it.
Never showed Tim Cook wearing those. I don't think it was that. Right. I think it's the spooky eyes. They really didn't want you to see Tim Cook's spooky eyes.
Sure. Okay.
Was the spooky eyes thing a good idea?
So you want to? You didn't ask.
You're addressing the concerns people have had with other things.
Yeah, but I'm going to tell you my whole opinion. Remember how everybody thought the Segway was going to change the way cities. Bill Gates said it was going to change the way cities are.
I thought that was a great idea.
And what happened was the single thing that killed the Segway is you looked like such a doofus because you were up there riding this platform. And I personally think, because we had Segways, I loved Segways. Right. But the fact that you looked like a doofus was enough to stop that. Apple has 4 or 5 of those issues. Because there's the goofy eyes. Nobody's going to want that. They showed a father taking pictures at the party of his kids blowing out candles. Dad, get out of the headset. He's got goofy eyes looking at them.
What's with Darth Vader back there?
And that's maybe it's just me. You tell me. But I have a visceral reaction to strapping screens on my head. It bugs me. I don't want to do it. And I think that I'm not the only one.
No, you're definitely not. Because if you weren't, this would have taken off already.
Any one of those. Right.
I think these are also the excuses. It used to be that carrying the phone visibly was socially unacceptable, too.
Sure.
It just became compelling enough that nobody cared.
Look, all I can say is if I see a video of Robert Scoble wearing one of these things in the freaking shower, I'm going to lose my mind.
They actually referred to that. They said there's no shower. No shower possible. Yeah. But I really do think that there's a difference between looking at a phone and strapping your phone to your face is such a hostile. Yeah. And a number of reviewers said it's a lonely experience. You're suddenly all alone.
That's right. We just came out of COVID, and now you want me to isolate myself from the rest of humanity?
It's like isolating.
It is kind of bad timing.
You look like a dork. You got goofy eyes. It costs $3,500. Right. And the problem is people are saying, oh, yeah, but wait, for 4 years, that doesn't matter. If this product dies, there were successors to the Segway that you didn't look like an idiot. Too late.
The original iPhone 2G was not a great phone.
Sure.
And, you know, the phone that we all love was the 4, right? Like, that's
we say that now,
phone.
But it was still, I mean, as somebody who bought one immediately, waited in line to get one, it was a big improvement over anything that we had today.
Yeah, it was. We're all in a bad place to opine on this because all of us know too much about the history of the industry and things that have come before, and all of our opinions are weighted by that.
Well, and I think and to some whether degree, or not Apple this thing gets is, a past because of that, because people say, "Well, look what they've done in the past," right?
I mean, it's just how many times can we be wrong before? I guess what I'm saying, I'm not saying this is going to be a smash success at all. That's not my point. My point is, I have used HoloLens. I have seen everything that this thing can do. And it colors my view of this thing, just like the iPad, all my 10 years of experience with tablet PCs. And by the way, I used dozens of different tablet PCs, colored my view of the iPad. You know, the it's, I just don't want to make that mistake again, you know? And I feel like if anyone could pull this off, any company could pull this off, it's Apple. That's all. I don't mean to say, because we've all been wrong so many times, we're going to be wrong this time. I don't mean it like that. But I think at some point we have to just wonder if this isn't, I don't know. Is this like a sub Apple Watch level of success?
I mean, part of what made the iPhone work is that you were buying it through your carrier. And so replacing it every two years, the carrier wanted to do that anyway. And you were paying by the month for your utilization. That's not how this headset works. And it's $3,500.
Sure.
V2 comes out a year from now. You get another $3,500.
I know. It's a tough sell. But you know, Apple's customer base is rich. They've shown a willingness to open their wallets.
And we're about to find out how rich
we are. Yeah. Well, we'll see. I feel like any other company did this, it would be like, that's cute. We've seen this before. It's Apple, though. They do have an incredible
And right at the moment that everybody else has pulled back from AR and VR across the board, they've lobbed in. And
by the way, not one word about AI.
But that's Apple's playbook, right?
Yeah.
Apple is almost never first to anything, but they kind of dive in when it makes sense for them and when they can make a big difference, right? We all know Apple's nowhere with AI, and that's a huge problem. But of course, I mean, the whole world is talking about AI, and they're like, "Hey, remember this thing from 4 years ago?" It's a little weird. I agree. I don't know.
You know, I am old enough and I've known this long enough to no longer be concerned about reputational damage.
What follows that statement is going to be amazing.
So I'm willing to call it as I see it. And, you know, I thought the iPhone was going to change the world. I thought the iPad, actually, I was overhyped on the iPad. I thought it was going to be bigger than it was. I thought the Newton was pretty great. I got three of them in a cabinet right behind me.
Sure.
So I am not somebody who's just going to poo-poo something because it's new technology, but I just think this is dead on arrival.
Wow. Step too far.
As they went to, and I understand what happened, which is they'd committed almost a decade. And and what must have been at least, I mean, I'm thinking $50 to $100 billion in the development.
Do you think ego plays any role in this? And like, this is a legacy product for Tim Cook, maybe?
It's not so much ego. Yes, it's partly that, but it's also, hey, we're all in because we have no choice. I think it's too hard for them to say, yeah, this isn't going anywhere. This made sense 5 years ago.
How long, they sat in the boardroom 3 months ago,
right,
and said, do we do this now or not?
Well, you know, they all said no, right?
No. Here's the story. The story is the design team said you cannot release this.
Right.
And Tim Cook overruled them.
Interesting.
Right.
So I think the design team was right. Although it's interesting because they had Alan Dye and others from the design team demoing it. So I think that they wanted to show, no, we're all unified behind this. They've showed it now to more than 100 journalists, not me, but 100 journalists, including some of ours. And of course, and I even warned people before this, you're going to hear these raves because it's, you know, VR technology is cool. You know, we all get excited about it when we wore the HoloLens for the first time or the Oculus for the first time. It wears off quickly. What's interesting to me is there are still quite a few journalists who are agreeing with my premise, which is this is A-plus technology, A-plus delivery. They really executed on a product no one wants. Now, maybe I'm poisoned because I look at this thing and I actually, my gut goes, oh, I do not want to strap a screen onto my face.
Yeah.
And that may be me. And so maybe I'm poisoning the well here. But I've been very negative on this, and I'm willing to do that. And I know in 3 years, if it's a success, people will, you know, show this video over and over again. That's fine. But I'm not trying to piss in your cornflakes.
Mine. It's not mine.
I think it's important for the tech press to be as honest as we can based on our experience.
I think there's a lack of perspective, though, right? And the younger guys who would be doing the YouTube stuff and blah, 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 whatever, they were not trying out HoloLens. They don't have that kind of background.
Sure.
They can get a little bit wowed by the new shiny bauble thing. You can't really trust that kind of opinion, but I find myself not trusting my own, you know, because
that's what I'm saying is trust yourself. Cause I don't think
I was blown away by the, the HoloLens technology. The initial version had that field of view problem we talked about a lot at the time. I don't want to say solved it. They improved. They made dramatic improvements with V2. And by the way, that was 4 years ago. Yeah. So,
and now, but what they're saying since. Point blank is we're not going to make another one until the tech's good enough, and the tech's not enough.
I even question whether the tech will ever be good enough.
Which is a cute out. I mean, I
they brought the version to the Army, and the Army said it wasn't good enough. And that was
the real version 3, right? I mean, I feel like with HoloLens, and this is true of a lot of technology, a lot of products that come out in personal tech, everyone who made it agreed it was cool. We weren't really sure what anyone would use it for. Let's throw it out in the world. You never know. Something will stick, you know? Mm-hmm. And they found some little niche kind of markets and whatever. But as a consumer product, it's a tougher sell. And at $3,500, I've owned several cars that cost less than that. I mean, it's a particularly hard sell.
Yeah. And it's a long-term buy. You're going to want years out of it. And, and so iterating, it's going to be difficult.
My only point is that it's possible for a product to actually, you know, we can all agree that someday this, you know, these lightweight, something you're wearing right now, Richard, will become a great reality device.
Right. A contact lens, right?
Or, well, whatever.
That kind of thing.
But the technologies are not there. They'd have to be invented. And I think by that time, we will all have given up on this category because of clunky products like this. So there's the risk.
I know. We put the Newton behind us.
We did.
For the iPhone.
And, like, I've likened this
to We get over Newton. Clunky products pretty fast.
Yeah, this is the Newton. Well, the iPhone took 15 years after the Newton.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, and the Newton followed things that were very basic but were similar, like Mr. Wizard or whatever that thing was called, the little clamshell devices. You could put your calendar in there and have your contacts Scion, and stuff. And,
yeah. I have to say, there's a clip somewhere of me holding up a Newton in 1994 saying, you add full-time internet connectivity and a phone to this, you got something. So it was clear when I
Are you saying an internet communicator device, a phone,
exactly.
and an iPod?
I saw the vision in 1994. Yeah. Took up 13 years to get to that point. But I think the Newton was a
Sometimes that's how long it takes.
Sometimes it does.
Yeah.
And it could be this is the Newton for whatever comes next.
Newton of this market.
Yeah. And if they do come out with spectacles with AR, I'll be the first in line to buy them. I think that's a great product.
Yeah.
Can we talk about the M2 Ultra? Because that internal GPU is an interesting shot at NVIDIA.
Right. Well,
oh my God, of course.
Apple's got a problem, right? They told us they'd release a Mac Pro. The Mac Pro, to me, means PCI slots. Yep, they have PCIe 4 slots that you could put a graphics processing unit into or multiple.
Right.
You can't with these new Apple Silicon chips. So they have to demonstrate that the GPU built into the silicon is going to be as good as any third party. And
preferably better, because it's got to, you're not going across the
bus.
Upgrade it. Being part of the chipset is powerful, right? Like, they have a distinct advantage by doing this.
You can upgrade it. You just buy a new one.
Yeah.
This is the Apple way. It's a perfect Apple product.
I don't have enough expertise in that area to know whether that's what pros want with a Mac Pro. I think it's a minor product for Apple. I think the Mac Studio is the much more important product.
That's right. That's right.
Oh, that
$2,000 versus seven and up. Yeah,
and the Air 15. That's the most beautiful computer made right now. Like, holy
I bought
man,
one instantly.
That's gorgeous.
Yeah, I'm getting it Tuesday. And I don't even need it because I have an M2 13 inch
right there.
but I've wanted.
I disagree, Leo. You do need it.
Well, fortunately, my daughter needs a laptop, so she's going to get the M2.
I love that the fully loaded Mac Pro is $12,000 before you buy a monitor. Grand.
Yeah.
And
Keith 512,
that's a league.
One of our IRC folks did a comparison between a loaded Mac Studio and a loaded Mac Pro, comparable, not loaded, but comparable.
Right.
And the Mac Pro is several thousand dollars more.
Yeah.
Just for
this is
slots.
The headroom that this is for Lucasfilm, right? You know, for Pixar or whatever. It's not for guy making web art. You know, or YouTube videos or whatever.
These are the new Spark stations, basically.
There is one thing though that I think should have you all trembling in your boots.
All right. I can't wait. I hope it's avatars without legs.
Notice they didn't even do that, right? If you do FaceTime and the vision thing, you just get a picture like a FaceTime picture, like your screen is on the wall. And that's not going to, that's no improvement.
No.
They didn't announce this, but it was announced later in a track, have created using Wine a compatibility layer that allows you to run DirectX 12
I got that
games.
Down. Yeah.
Yes,
right.
To me, so, that's maybe the most important thing from the point of view of gamers and Windows gamers.
Yeah.
And certainly for us Mac users, that's good news.
This is the hole in the Mac, right, is the game's strategy. Yeah. So this is a step to addressing it. This is the boot camp, you know, for gaming or something. Like, let's get this in through the back door. I don't know. I don't know that Wine has turned Linux into a viable Windows app running desktop operating system. So games are a little more complicated. I guess we'll see. But Apple putting their weight behind it is going to help for sure.
Anyway, yeah, that's the only thing that could rock anybody's boat. I think everything else is more ecosystem play, right? It's Apple for Applers, and the rest of us can kind of ignore it. Although, do you, as a Windows user, do you lust for the 15-inch MacBook Air?
A beautiful computer is a beautiful computer, man.
Yeah, I like the computer. Yeah, it's a hardware thing. I don't want to run Mac OS.
Yeah, you're exactly right. You know what I dug out? I'm cleaning out the office because things are afoot. I found my old Toshiba Ultrabook, first generation. It's like fourth gen Intel in it.
I remember that.
With the edges so sharp, you could julienne carrots with it, right? Just a beautiful machine. Yes. Then I fired it up, realized it was on the insider build and had Win 11 on it. Now I'm like,
what?
Right.
Ow.
I actually thought of you, Richard, when they did the 15-inch MacBook Air, and I was like, I don't know.
Yeah.
You could run Windows 11 on ARM.
Oh, I'm immediately putting Parallels on it and Windows.
It's loaded. It's $2,000 Canadian. Like, I have a tough time buying a good quality Windows laptop for that much money. Right. Like, when did the Mac become the inexpensive option?
Yeah,
like,
it's bizarre. If you look at premium laptops, it hits at a good price. It's a good price for that.
Yeah, $3,000 is in Canadian dollars is basically what I'm looking at for any decent, laptop. That's all the surfaces. That's a top tier HP Spectra. Like, that's
sure.
That's what you're looking at. So suddenly you look at the Air and you're like, $2,000? Yeah, holy man. I don't know if I'd use it anything, but I would pet it.
I know.
Yeah,
no, I spent a curious amount of time choosing the color. Yeah, you know, that kind of thing.
Well, as somebody who bought the midnight blue of the previous version, don't. It's a fingerprint magnet. I had to put it in a case because otherwise it just looks so messed
up. It's always smudged.
Yeah, so I bought the silver one. Lisa bought a silver MacBook Pro, and I thought, you know what? That's a nice kind of almost a retro thing now to get a silver laptop. So I'll have it next week, and you can look at it. Yeah,
yeah, I'm curious about it. Sure.
The thing, there's an interesting psychology thing. It's 3.3 pounds, but because it's so big, people say it seems so light.
Well, by the way, so 3.3 pounds for a 15-inch laptop is light. 3.3 pounds is very typical for like a 14-inch laptop.
Yeah.
3.7, 3.9 for a 16 is not uncommon. So 3.3, that's actually light. That is light for that size.
And I will put Windows on it immediately.
Yeah.
You know what I found? Yes. Lifehacker. Tell me if I got ripped off. Last couple of weeks ago, I should have mentioned it. Lifehacker had a deal, $40 for a Windows 11 license that you could use on three different machines.
I just saw that. Yeah, that's a good price for that. I don't understand three computers, so I don't know where that comes from. But
that because of emulation, right? So I need a license for my Mac as well as a Windows machine. I don't know. I thought $40. I just bought it because I don't need it, but I bought it. I could use three licenses. You could use three licenses.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
You got another
one you
can
put on the Mac.
Yeah, mostly it's for the Mac because every PC comes with a license. So,
yep.
Yeah. I have enough.
Well, you could build, buy a NUC or something, or build your own computer. It's, it's a good price.
Yeah. I have things I run in Windows on in emulation.
I mean, legally, one license is $199.
I know. So. I thought $40. Even if it's just one, it's fine. I paid $130 for my, and it's Pro, by the way, for my Windows 11 license for my VM.
Yeah. No, I think I saw it today it was $50, if I'm not mistaken, but yeah, I saw something about that.
So that's legit. Microsoft's doing that, huh?
I don't know what it is, but it's,
it's
legal, I guess.
It's legal. Yeah. I don't think Lifehacker would do it.
It's not from Microsoft or anything.
Yeah, some special OEM thing.
Well, and we can go to more joyful news, like the death of Cortana. I'm excited about that.
Oh, my God. Poor Cortana.
Yeah, both guys are really upset.
Before we do, I ran Cortana on my PC for the first time just to kind of remind myself. And I can't say that I'm going to mourn its passing.
Let me take a little break so we can get an ad in, and then the death. We'll have a little. Should we have a little funeral?
A little wake. I'll go grab a whiskey
for dear old.
Can turn
Cortana.
Into one of those New Orleans things where it's really a party with trombones and
an umbrella going up and down.
A Cortana march.
Our show today, real quickly,
brought to you by.
Just want to mention this a great podcast. It's called AWS Insiders. It's the AWS Insiders podcast. Fast paced, it's entertaining, but I think it's also insightful. And this is what, you know, I look for. Ideally, a podcast should both make me, you know, enjoy myself listening to it, and I come away with it learning something. That's exactly what you get from AWS Insiders. It's a look behind the scenes of Amazon Web Services. It's a high production value, not like our stuff, where it's just a couple of people talking. It's high energy, high entertainment, full of captivating stories from the early days of AWS. And boy, when you listen, there are amazing stories behind the scenes from the good old days, but also to today and beyond. The host, Rahul, is great. I'm going to try his last name, Rahul Subramaniam. I'll just call him Rahul. And Hillary Doyle, they dig into the current state and the future of AWS by talking with people and companies that know it best. Rahul knows because he's a veteran AWS pro, 15 years of experience managing, hold on to your hats, 45,000 AWS instances. He knows how to push AWS to its limits. And he's clearly, you know, a believer in the power of AWS, the operating system of the future, he calls it. AWS Insiders is a show that's full of opinions, takeaways, untold stories. That's the three things I want about the challenges, innovations, and mind-blowing promise of cloud computing. A couple of episodes you might be in. The season two just came out. The first episode, Filling the Cloud Talent Gap, How to Staff Your Cloud Team, Solutions to Finding, Retaining, and Leveling Up Cloud Talent. What else? There was episode three was great. It was all about Moderna and the mRNA vaccines. I didn't know this. They had Moderna's director of data engineering and cloud on, but Moderna very much used AWS in the development of the COVID vaccine. Fascinating story. Search for AWS Insiders on your podcast player or just visit the website cloudfix.aurea.com/podcast. cloudfix.aurea.com/podcast. You see it if you're watching the video. It's in the lower third here. We'll also put a link at twit.tv/ww in the show notes for this episode. And of course, you can search for AWS Insiders in your favorite podcast player. cloudfix.aurea.com/podcast. Thank you, AWS Insiders, for supporting Windows Weekly. I was so in on Cortana that I bought the Harman Kardon.
You got one, huh?
Oh, yeah.
I was going to get one of those, but
somewhere I should find it. The thing I liked about it is
it could sit beside your Newton.
Yeah, exactly. It's probably back there. I'll have to look in my Dr. Laporte's closet of technology oddities. You tapped it on the head. Which is a very, like little pat, and it would give you a fact. It was like a Snapple bottle cap. You just tap it on your head and you get a little factoid. That was it. That's my highlight right there.
That was the feature. That was the only feature you used.
Yeah. Never use it on the desktop. So they killed the Harman Kardon thing. It turned into just a Bluetooth speaker. They've killed it pretty much in every form. This is the final nail in the coffin. Yes.
Well, yeah, they killed the mobile apps a couple of years ago. They've been kind of stepping back for it from a while. When Windows 11 came out, it was Cortana was deprecated, remember?
Yep.
And now they've announced that they're going to end support for sometime this year. They haven't given a date. But of course, it's just on the way out. But, Microsoft has been busy kind of crapping on Cortana since they came out with this AI stuff. Remember the Satya Nadella interview where he said all that stuff? That was just cute.
But wouldn't this be an opportunity to put ChatGPT into Cortana and make it somehow useful?
Yeah, so this is a marketing exercise. Cortana as a brand failed, so they have to go forward with a new brand because no one has heard of Cortana, and those who have know it's a failure. By the way, most of the people outside of the United States never even got a chance to use Cortana. That was a big issue in Windows Phone when Windows Phone was one of the most popular phones in Europe, they couldn't even use Cortana, right? It was just, the whole thing was just kind of mismanaged from the beginning.
Well, and it was a Halo brand in the first place, yeah, for an over-sexualized digital body, yeah, right? Like, true, it was a mistake from the outset.
Yes, right. A lot of, well, the other companies that still make these things are busy working on other voices. You can have men and women voices and all this kind of stuff. But the only thing I find a little odd about all this is that it's very clear that the Copilot technologies we'll see in Windows or Microsoft 365 or whatever are kind of the next gen version of what Cortana was, right? I had an editorial in a newsletter where I was like, you know, comparing the marketing of Cortana back in 2014 or whatever year it was, 13, with the way they're marketing Copilot in Windows today. And it's, the parallels are kind of amazing. It's almost exactly the same language. And it's a little frustrating. You know, Cortana was the future and now AI is the future. So suck it up, everybody. We're moving forward, you know. But Cortana also, I think, suffered from the fact, because it was a kind of a failed brand, not something they could slap a dollar sign in front of, right? They couldn't charge for that. You know, if the people who like the Cortana brand, you know, why don't you just use Cortana? It's kind of a cool brand, you know, because if they try to, you know, charge you for it, it would, people would have said, what are you talking about? We're not paying for this thing. That's ridiculous. I think this is for a number of factors. We're just going to walk past it, right? We're going to pretend this never happened. So. There are things in Windows 10 that made sense on Windows Phone that just didn't make sense on the PC, like Live Tiles and Cortana, right? I mean, Cortana, when you're on your phone, it kind of makes sense. You might want to talk to interact with it. That said, I will say it's a little strange to me, and I looked through some of the demos to make sure I wasn't missing something. When you use Copilot in Windows 11 coming soon, you're typing into the computer. You type. You don't talk to it, right? Right. Naturally, the most natural language is speech, you know, and in that way, assuming they don't do it, I mean, I think they will eventually, if they're not going to do it right away, add that capability. It is kind of a step back, isn't it? I mean, we're just at the point now where you can have conversations with these assistants and ask follow-up questions without, you know, having to prompt them again or whatever.
Yeah, I think this whole genre is going to have to be rethought. I mean, and part of the problem here is that, and we're starting to see more stories online.
Yeah.
These large language models cost a lot of money to operate.
Right.
Like, I don't think Microsoft wants to make it too easy to use.
Yep.
Because they're not charging for it enough yet. Part of me wonders if GPT-4 will even make it, because it's so massively expensive, and 3 and 3.5.
Yeah.
Seem to be good enough for certain verticals. So
this is something Microsoft is very careful not to discuss right now, and it's getting a little weird. I noticed an incident last week where Frank Shaw, the communications director of Microsoft, lashed out at The Information, which is a highly regarded online publication that's paid only, for outing the price of what this the Microsoft 365 Copilot was going to be. And he went to town on them for that. And because what they were writing was inaccurate and blah, 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 whatever. But I kind of chatted with Mary Jo about it. And I'm like, I think that's the price. You know, yeah,
I think you probably nailed it.
I think they got the price. Yeah. And this is the thing they don't want people to talk about right now. Let's just get excited about the capabilities. You know, we'll talk about pricing later.
Well, and they need to, because they're going to need millions of users.
Yes.
To be paying monthly.
Yep. There's all this stuff that goes into this. You know, NVIDIA just became a $1 trillion company.
Yes.
And NVIDIA, who just a goofy little graphics card company for PCs, has turned into the next $1 trillion company through the grace of God, you know?
Well, again, they thought it was going to be NFTs. It turned out to be LLMs.
Yep. Yep.
But there's still a majority of their sales. Like, I looked at the latest quarterlies, like, they're still mostly selling graphics cards for PCs.
Right.
And this data center is right behind. Like,
this follows
next quarter, it'll be data center.
Yeah, this is my theory about, you know, this is the wag the dog kind of thing, right? Like, they're sailing on the promise of AI, just like Microsoft sailed for 10 years on the promise of the cloud. Yep. And now we're hoping to do the same with AI, right? This is how Wall Street works, in a way, as if there's any way to explain how Wall Street works. But it is a lot of speculation, a lot of, you know, we're looking for little things. You know, you warn about the future and the whole thing nosedives. But there are certain little phrases you can use and just send the stock soaring. And AI is
It's the biggest one. The current one, yeah, right? It's the one. Just happens to be the current hype one. Like, yep. But it's a cycle, right? We've seen it before, and it is a time for folks in our situation to take a step back. It's like, don't get caught in the hype. Yep. It is hype.
That's
right?
Why,
like, at least know the difference.
While you were talking about that, I just went out of sight.
He refused to discuss it.
I don't get. You're going to trigger me.
I'm recusing myself from this conversation.
I don't want to get triggered.
I'm above the hype.
Well, I'm doing my best to resist it while still exploring this stuff, because you make bad decisions. You know, when you're pulled in the hype. And you'd also look at the reasoning, and like, Microsoft's reasoning is completely sensible. They need to sign millions of customers. Why are they starting with their largest M365 customers for Copilot? Right. It's the best chance for success. They'll push it out to dozens of different departments inside of these big organizations, and one or two of them are going to resonate on it. And that will be the talking point.
Right.
That today, you need a win.
Today, Google updated Bard to be better at coding. So they're paying attention to this, you know.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And the GitHub Copilot scenario is a really great scenario because it's a narrow data set.
Yeah. Right.
Right.
That and
takes
it works
a skilled
well.
Operator to use. Yeah. It's one of the ones that can work well. I just don't know how many others there are.
I must have this in here somewhere. I'm forgetting what I put in the notes, but I think the promise of the Windows 10 or 11 Copilot specifically is going to be based on what happens with third-party plugins, right? That's what's going to make it exciting.
Yes.
Because if you look at the list of features they announced, it is nothing. It's nothing. Mm-hmm. It's like, I'm going to chat with the computer to figure out how to use dark mode. Are you kidding me?
Well, the problem you got with Windows Copilot is you have to look at the Windows app suite. You know, the thing that nobody uses. They go get Office.
Right.
There's a risk, though, because that looks a lot like Bixby when you say, give me a Spotify playlist or put me in dark mode.
Is there a way I could make the computer a little darker? Like, I'm just going to use it. It's like, I keep referencing Zork in these kind of parser-based games from the 70s. But, like, seriously, like, you have to trigger the exact right word. We have dark mode. I'm so glad you used that word, you know. It just doesn't seem smart to me.
I am in a maze of twisty little passages all alike.
Yes,
Plug.
Open the mailbox.
It's dark. It's dark. You're in danger of being eaten by a grue.
Right. I used to draw maps, you know, to follow along.
And Richard disappeared in a greasy puff of smoke. And we never saw him again.
Never seen again.
So look, there's some cool stuff there for sure. I mean, you can drag a document on, it says you want a summary, that kind of thing. That's neat. That's really neat. It is neat. But we're really talking about two or three very specific features. And I think like any platform, I mean, the thing that makes this exciting is other companies are going to build off of it and create things that might be exciting to you personally. Right. So we'll see how it goes. Launching a Spotify playlist, whatever. But
and that's the thing is, if I'm a successful company, you're basically asking to hijack my UI with my plugin. Like, is that in my best interest?
Are you talking about Windows Phone now? Because that's exactly the problem.
Now, if I'm a subscription based product like a Spotify, I don't give a crap what UI you use. That's fine.
Sure.
Right. As long as I make my money, more users, more better.
By the way, that's going to pay. I'm fascinated that you just said that, because the other example they used was Adobe CC.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, both of the things they showed that were third parties were subscription services.
Have to be subscription services, because otherwise I want you in my client.
Yep. Smart. Yep. Well, I can tell you my .NET pad's not going in there. Screw those guys. I don't even know what that means. I'm not sure.
He's starting to say random phrases.
I know, I'm just talking.
Now who's got hallucination?
Exactly. I invented hallucination, sir.
Somebody I saw this morning, of course, more and more companies are saying, we're going to let go of 5% more of our programmers because we're going to use Copilot.
Yeah.
And somebody said, that's like saying, we don't need any more programmers. We're going to use Stack Overflow. We got this handled. Yeah.
I need desperately for The Onion to write an article. We interviewed the guy who actually did lose his job to ChatGPT, and it turns out he's kind of a loser. it's like this is Bob. Bob actually didn't do anything. You know, he was that guy just kind of coasting every day.
Yeah.
I don't know.
The latest excuse. Oh, Teams? Really? Another consumer Teams? Really?
Remember in 1999 when Microsoft came out with Windows 2000, you booted the thing up and it said, Windows 2000, powered by NT technology. And we all were like, oh, God damn it.
Yeah. You know?
So I think what they need to do is just get rid of Skype, make consumer Teams the thing and say, powered by Skype technology. Because here's the thing that's sad about the consumer version of Teams. Actually, there's a couple of things that are sad about it. One, no one knows it exists. Two, when they run into it, nobody wants it. It's in Windows 11. Nobody cares. Three, and this is the most amazing one, it's actually pretty damn good. And that's what really stinks about it. Teams for consumers is the lightweight version of Teams that everybody kind of really wants.
It's
the
Skype.
Problem is no one uses it. Yeah. So you're just talking to yourself, you know?
And therein lies the real issue, which is the only time I ever run into this version of Teams is when I click on it by mistake because I actually need to use Teams. Yep.
Here's what they should have done, though.
Just make it Skype.
They could have just fixed it. Right, exactly. I don't know how you release this product and have it not the first time you click on it by mistake. Say, hey, this is replacing Skype. Click yes to have us import all your Skype stuff. Your other friends can keep using Skype if they have it on their phones or whatever they use Skype for. It will work. It's just going to work. But they didn't do that. They did not do that. And it's astonishing to me. We're closing in 2 years. I've never heard of any plans to do that. And I don't want to call it the most Microsoft thing ever, but it's so perfect that Microsoft would do something like this. Mm. It just doesn't make sense.
It's so Why? Microsoft.
They should have just replaced Skype.
Because the last versions of Skype are not bad.
Skype is good too.
They're saturated in fake girlfriends and nobody's else has got one running. And when you ask someone to turn it on, it's like, please stand by while I patch for an hour.
Sure.
You know,
Wait a minute. I'm not going to skim over saturated by fake girlfriends. I know what you're talking about, but is that a feature?
It's a byproduct.
A byproduct of neglect by the back end services have meant that bit by bit, the various exploiters find ways in to get access to accounts and they start messaging people en masse to see if they can get a hit.
The only thing that gets hit worse by this than Skype is PayPal. How many times have you gotten like the fake invoice and then you go to report it and it comes up with like a fake URL that doesn't work and then you just can't do it. Like PayPal just doesn't care.
There's nothing to do. Just delete the message.
Don't delete it. Don't worry about it.
That fake M365 account messages are awesome too. Lots of those. And those all seem to make it through the filter.
Right.
Microsoft's supposed to run.
Yep.
Yeah. It is an interesting situation. And the alternative is basically give in to Zoom because Zoom seems to own the consumer market quite well.
That's right.
Although they're jacking their prices up now and the free services are getting tighter too.
Although in certain circles, being saturated by fake girlfriends might be a feature they could promote.
Yeah, right. It's called Instagram.
That's right. Okay.
I remember that place you used to go to look at photos?
Oh, man, is it awful?
Remember it was about photos?
Actually,
people now are like, I don't even know what you're talking. I don't think it ever was about photos. I'm pretty sure it was always about shopping.
Every other picture now?
Ads. Exactly.
Pretty much, yeah.
And for me, and I'm sorry to say this, and I think it's my age, it's all ED medicine. Every ad, I'm starting to feel like, is there something wrong with me?
Are you trying to tell me something? What's this about?
I'm sure it's age-related.
I mean, A, how do you know I need this? And B, it's terrible. Well, this is the ingenification thing, right? This is what happens, right? Yeah. We have an audience. Let's ruin it. You know. Nice.
Thank you. Jeez. Plus a bunch of people I don't follow.
I know.
Even better.
No, I it's astonishing to me how useless.
See a lot of photos from you. So you haven't.
No, I like the idea of it. Yeah, right. So. Yeah.
I think you post good photos. You post pictures of trains. That's always.
I'm on message.
Pictures of food.
Yeah.
That's it.
It's pretty much my wheelhouse right there. Yeah. But what I get in return is not a lot, right? I'll see occasional posts from your wife, for example, or a couple of family members use it. But like, honestly, it's mostly what we just described. It's a lot of scrolling to get by. And when you get past the fold where it's like you've seen all the posts and now it's just sponsored nonsense.
Just ads.
Yeah. It is ads, but it's also like the non-ad things are for some reason 100% amateur sports videos for me. And I just, geez, guys, this is not why I'm here. It's not why I'm here.
All these products are all of these second generation social media projects are eating their heads. Like they're just unraveling.
It's sad. Across the board. It really bothers me.
It couldn't happen to a nicer bunch of folks.
I don't feel bad about Meta. I just feel, I wish some regulator would take this thing away and have it just go back to being what it was, you know, God forbid. But
yeah, I don't think there's no way.
Listen, I'm the original. We are, I guess, all the original generation of people who complained about MTV not being about music. That's exactly what this complaint is. It's exactly the same.
You remember when the History Channel was about history? How strange.
Oh, yeah. God. Right. Bravo used to be about, I don't know what Bravo was about, but I know what it is. What about
it was
now.
About Westerns and Turner Classic Movies, pretty much.
Yeah. Yeah.
Tech TV used to be about tech.
Weird. Yeah. Time for the Windows Insider stuff.
Yes.
I'm going to have to wear a noise canceling.
Because I finally dusted off that old Samsung and saw that I had Insider on it. And now I should pay.
And I want to know because as you remember last week, I turned on Insiders on
You're
here.
Still patching. Yeah.
No, it's done. It rebooted three times or something. But it's. I want to know, what do I have? What do I got?
Wait, are you serious? You haven't gotten in still?
No. I got it. It's done.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
No, it's done.
So
no,
what do you want? You must be on beta?
Yeah. I was on I can't remember.
You're not on Canary.
No, but God, I'm on the next one up, which I guess is beta, right?
Well, dev is the next and then beta.
No, I don't think I'm dev. I must be beta.
I think you're beta.
If I did system WinX, let's see here.
So if you go into settings and go to, it's actually system. In the first part of settings.
Yeah.
Yep, system, go down to the bottom.
It is,
that's
right.
I am
running. Let's press a button here so that you can see it. I am running Windows 11 Pro Insider Preview.
But it doesn't say the channel.
Is that a thing?
So go into go to Windows Update on the side.
Can you
and then
guys,
go to Windows Insider
Preview. Put my screen, my HDMI screen into the, I don't know what you've got set up over in cameras 7 and 8. That's not what I want. I see 22H2, 23471.1000. Windows Feature Experience Pack.
You're still in system, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, go on left click on Windows Update.
Oh. Well, just to tell you what track I'm on, right. Okay.
Yeah. Well, yes. This will tell you the track.
I'll tell you. I am on Windows Insider Program. I am on Dev.
Oh, no.
Did I blow it?
It's probably fine. No, actually, you're probably in a good place because.
Wait a minute. It says a newer build is available in Windows Update.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that build in a second. There's something interesting going on there.
Okay. I'm waiting. I'm listening.
So dev and beta will have access to a new version of Microsoft Paint that finally adds dark mode. This thing that they, 2 years later. I don't know that it's going to fix the complaint I had about Microsoft Paint. Remember, you bring up the info box and you have to resize it and it doesn't let you enter and get out of it and it does whatever. I doubt it fixes that, but it's at least not going to blow your eyeballs out if you use dark mode. So that's cool. That's coming to Canary and dev, not dev and beta. So I don't think everyone gets it right away, but once you have this new build installed, maybe it doesn't matter if you have the new build installed, you should check for updates. You might be able to get that. So that's good. There have been, by my count, 5 builds since the last time we talked.
Holy man.
2 to dev each, 2 to Canary, and 1 to beta, I think, is the total, if I'm not mistaken. But nothing much going on in Canary. However, dev has gotten some interesting stuff, Leo, so you'll be able to get some good stuff going. So in the latest build, there is a new home view in File Explorer, which is they're basically turning it into, I'm bringing up File Explorer like I can see it, which I can't, but they're basically turning it into the view you get if you go to like OneDrive.com and you have kind of a carousel at the top with places to go and recent files and all that kind of stuff. It's sort of the view you get in the, what's now called the Microsoft 365 app, for example. That's okay, you know.
So it's more of your past files
and
emails are sprinkled in there too. So it's sort of a this is what you've been doing lately.
Yeah,
kind of view.
Yeah, It's sort of what they were trying to do with this new Start menu in Windows 11. We have that recommended section, which is an ill-advised combination of recently installed apps as well as recently accessed documents or whatever. I think the closest analog is probably OneDrive.com or maybe the Microsoft 365 app. Right. That's cool. That's fine. The previous build, the one you're probably on, no one can hear what I'm hearing, right? It's driving me insane.
Just you.
Yeah. Good. This is getting in my head.
I hear it. I was just getting my screens back. So I can
no,
show
I'm,
you.
I'm talking about the banging I can hear.
Oh, I don't hear any banging now.
Yeah,
no. Good.
So go ahead. Tell me what I got.
No, I was just going to say there's also stuff going around with going on that with File Explorer tabs, and there's a gallery view. This is the view that is available in the Photos app. So if you're in a folder full of photos, you'll get like this nice view. You can scroll through with the date on the side, et cetera, et cetera. That's kind of cool.
But I have to make room for my memories.
You sure do. So actually, if I'm not mistaken, I think that might be the new, there's kind of a new camera roll integration occurring here as well. So you can click a button in the silver
and it says like add to file. I have like 2 terabytes or something on.
Yeah, but you're assuming that Microsoft knows anything about what we have.
And when I first turned on the computer, it said OneDrive is down.
Oh, there you go. You got to re-authenticate.
Yep.
Yeah.
As usual.
Oh, need access to the prior app? That's a nice feature. You can download Photos Legacy if you want the old one.
So the old Photos app had a different layout, but they also had like kind of a basic video editor built in for some reason. Now we have ClipJam, so we don't really need that.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's much better than the old thing, but.
Oh, this is interesting. It has a iCloud Photos over here in the sidebar.
Yeah, that's been there for a little while.
That's very generous of them.
Mm-hmm.
Mention the other
guys. Because, 50% of the people that access this thing use an iPhone, right? So this is a way to get those photos in.
Sure.
Without requiring the direct access.
Yeah, I'm going to install that. That's cool. Yep. All right.
Yeah. So there's some good stuff you should be able to see. Also, one thing that's you'll have to have a PC that takes advantage of this, but there's a lot of PC peripherals and PCs, if they're laptops, gaming laptops, that offer dynamic lighting. So you might have dynamic lighting. The keyboard, you have like Razer mice that offer this, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
They're moving dynamic lighting as a formal feature of Windows 11 in settings. It's something that all of these makers of these devices are going to latch into and let you control that stuff instead of through Windows rather than using like a custom UI for it.
So you end up with a bunch of little apps, although if you bought all Logitech gear, Logitech consolidates all that in their hub, which is a little more sensible. I'm wondering about bias lighting. Like that's becoming hipper to stick LED, RGB LEDs on my monitor.
You would have in a home. Exactly. Yeah. I think that's going to be part of it too. It's a little bit like the presence sensors. Like, so Microsoft is moving or has already moved presence sensing into settings. Mm-hmm. There's nothing in Windows that can take advantage of it, but third parties do it by which I mean PC makers. And the idea there is that you walk up to your computer, it senses you coming. So it wakes up, and that way, if you're using Windows Hello facial recognition, that happens immediately.
Right.
Whereas today, you kind of have to sit down in front of it, maybe even have to turn it on
and poke at it a bit, to get it to react.
Yep. So they're starting to move stuff into settings and kind of formalize it as part of Windows. I think that's a good idea.
Yeah, no, it's great. It's great. What's fascinating is they don't have a product in this. They're literally writing software.
Yeah.
To support their ecosystem. What a concept.
This is, in sharp contrast to his, a baloney new feature in Windows. It's like, here you go. Like, this is stuff people are actually already using. Let's bring it into Windows. And then
let's make it a little easier.
Actually reach out to hardware makers and say, hey, we're doing this thing,
Yeah.
And then they integrate with it. So it's good.
Yeah. And just know it's already there. You're not going to have to walk people through installing software. You're not going to have to support it. Just give us a driver. Here you go. Thanks for playing.
Yeah. I mean, today, if you buy a new like ThinkPad and ThinkPads might, some of them do have, or maybe most of them have this presence sensing technology built in. You have to go into Lenovo Vantage. You have to know where to look. You can play with it there, but now this, make it part of Windows.
I mean, you have to wonder if this was enough tech support calls to Microsoft where they kept saying you have to call the vendor and making people angry to finally say, hey, if we build this bit, then we can provide support for it.
So, so those two features. And then a third one, which came up back when I reviewed a computer called the HP Dragonfly Pro, which uses an AMD processor that takes over power management for you. So it doesn't matter what you do in power management. It just ignores it. And the idea is, we know how to do this. We're going to do it for you dynamically. There's no way for us to control the Windows UI, so we can't help there. But we have our, you can turn it off if you want, but you'd be stupid to do that because this computer has kind of i7 level performance, but it also gets 11 hours of battery life. It actually works. Like, it's great. So no one should ever turn this off. But they went to Microsoft and said, hey, it'd be kind of nice if, you know, this was just something we can do.
Yeah.
And that is going to be something you can do in the future. So that's coming. And I feel like this presence sensing stuff, this dynamic lighting stuff is maybe part of that same set of conversations they might have had with PC makers, who are still their most important partners on the client, right?
So Now, this is kind of the kinder, gentler tech giant thing, right?
Like,
And the Windows team trying to figure out how to do stuff that the ecosystem is going to benefit from. Like,
actually,
nothing more, one of the more complicated things, just going down the list of what are we getting the most calls on? Right. It's this thing. Let's make it go away.
I just thought of another one, but I can't think of the name of it. There's a feature coming to Windows. It has to be supported by PC Maker because it's part of the display technology that works a little bit like OLED works. You know, with OLED, if that part of the screen is black, there's nothing has to light up. It's black. They just turn it off. Mm-hmm. And they're doing a dynamic version of that where you can have HDR just where the video is playing, but not in the rest of the screen or whatever, you know.
Wow.
That's something the hardware, you know, the PC maker has to have that hardware in the PC and has to support it, and normally would have to create a an app or a utility or some kind of control it. It's like, hey, could we just put this into Windows? And they're putting it into Windows.
Yeah.
So no one's listening to Microsoft's customers. They're listening to Microsoft partners. It's a very important distinction here. You know. But anyway, it's happening. So that benefits all of us. It's good.
Yeah, it's amazing.
So anyway, that's most of what's happening in the Insider program, I guess.
Nothing to get all head up about.
Mm-hmm.
No,
it
but
ain't
in your
no
case,
Vision Pro.
No.
Oh
well, but you are going to see. So once you get this build installed, which hopefully will happen before we're done, but we'll see. These things take a while. You will have a more modern version of File Explorer that actually has a bunch of new stuff going on. So that's actually kind of interesting.
Cool.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let me push the button then.
Yeah.
And go
wrong.
What could possibly? I love updating my machine during a show. I just think there's something.
It's the
about
best.
It.
Yeah, and I think it's honestly at this point it's a tradition. You know,
tradition. Open Windows update. Yeah. I thought I was in Windows update, but okay. Check for updates. And then it's going to say
get the new build.
That's what's weird because it said there's a new build.
Process to me is a little dodgy. Yeah, exactly. Dodgy. If you know there's a new build, just let me click something and get it.
Yeah, get it.
Because sometimes you'll come here and it'll say, you're up to date. It's like, they just told me there was a new build.
Yeah. And this is all because I have joined the Insider program and flipped the switch, get the latest updates as soon as they're available.
Yeah.
I don't even need that anymore, right? Because I'm in the beta. Check right the beta
that's probably true
that supersedes see this
right
that's so frustrating
classic
you're in the loop
okay it's still Don't checking worry. All right well I
there's always an update
I won't hold down hold down
no it's okay here. it's just irritating
all right
spinning
workspaces for Edge.
Yeah, so at Build, Microsoft showed off a brand new version of Edge. It's a beautiful new UI, and they just released a new version of Edge this past week, and it does not have that new UI. So that's Microsoft. Again, classic Microsoft. The only way to see it today is to install the beta version of Edge and then turn on some flags, and you can get rounded UI and the floating tab.
But it sounds like you basically need an M365 account to use this because you need OneDrive.
To get workspaces.
You need AAD. Like, it's an enterprise product feature, essentially.
The workspaces feature. Yeah, so I was kind of hoping there was going to be more stuff to this release because they've been, you know, in addition to the new UI stuff, there's the ability to pin the Edge sidebar to the side of Windows like the Windows sidebar used to be.
Right.
Is coming. That didn't seem like a particularly exciting feature until about a month ago when they added all that Bing AI stuff to the Edge sidebar. And now it's like, oh, actually, a lot like the Copilot feature we just were talking about. It could be the sidebar over the side where I can access image creation, chatbot, you know, the create functionality. We can create letters or emails or whatever.
Right.
Honestly, having that pinned to the side of the screen. That's kind of interesting. Yeah. So that's none of that's there. So all that exciting stuff I just mentioned, not there. The only new feature is Workspaces. Like I said, it does require an AAD account. I don't understand why Workspaces can't be brought to consumer Microsoft 365 accounts or whatever, but
yeah. Okay. Yeah, I don't know why. I can understand the AAD account, which is not that hard to come by. And yeah. You can have one, essentially. The OneDrive for business license is the one. Like, that's not a small thing.
That's right.
That means an administrator.
Right, right. So, yeah, yet another way to collaborate, I guess. You know, this is Microsoft. This is the little bit. Okay, the other thing I didn't say in that story about developers, the developer story part where Microsoft and Google addressed their markets a little differently than Apple does. Apple requires its developers to meet them where they are.
Right.
Google and Microsoft will meet you where you are. And this is a great example of that
even if you're doing the weather, it'll meet you where you are. Sure. Thanks, sure. Patrick Delahanty, for sharing that little.
Yes, I would like to upgrade. Thank you. Someone should have said, you know what? We're doing this right now.
But, you know, I could imagine setting up a workspace for .NET Rocks related links, right? Yes, like often right.
You're collaborating,
products
right?
and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. People collaborate in different ways. I mean, it's okay. I do feel like at some point we have too many ways to do things, you know?
But isn't that the Microsoft way, right?
It is the Microsoft way.
It's not truly done until there's six ways to do it and three of them will shoot your foot off.
Right. Right. I'm reading a book about Commodore right now, and one of the great quotes is like, you've heard the phrase shoot yourself in the foot. With Commodore, they put their foot in their mouth first, then they shoot themselves in the foot.
Oh, God.
Yeah, I thought that was pretty good. Yep.
I now have to issue a trigger warning for this show. Thanks a lot for that.
Yep, sorry. It's a phrase. I didn't invent the phrase.
It doesn't mean anything.
So... as everyone knows by now, I'm sure, like I recommend the Brave web browser.
I have one of my workstations switch over to Brave. I yell at you about it every day.
Okay. So the one area that I would say Brave is behind, and this is an area that doesn't matter to me too much, is on the new UI stuff, right? So I just talked about this Edge sidebar, whatever. Sidebars are kind of all the rage right now with browsers. There's this ongoing thing at Microsoft, especially, but also elsewhere, about this notion of doing things side by side, right? This is the dual screen devices they did and didn't do, like Neo. It's the split screen feature in Microsoft Edge, where it's like, we need another way to split the screen up. Yeah. Obviously, Snap is one of those many ways. Multi-screen is another way, obviously. But this notion of like you're doing some big work over here, but you might have this little thing over here. Maybe you want to keep track of a live sports game. Maybe you're taking notes while you're watching a video, or maybe, you know, but who knows, but it doesn't matter, but a lot of different things. And I feel like this part of our world is like almost obsessed by this right now. Mm. And even Brave actually has a little sidebar thing, which I turn off immediately. So I don't even know what's in it, but Brave is generally speaking behind on the user facing kind of UI fun stuff that, Microsoft Edge is really into. Google is a little bit into with Chrome. If you're really into the stuff, get Vivaldi. Vivaldi is a very safe web browser that is just all about customization. I find it to be a little much about customization. Anyway, to show you how far behind the times they are, Brave just this week added support for vertical tabs, a feature that other browsers have had for a long time.
So. And I mean, the upside to that is we have more horizontal real estate than vertical real estate. So moving the tabs vertically consumes more horizontal real estate.
I cannot agree with you more, but here's the caveat to that, because I literally started writing a little screed about that very topic. I'm like, right as we're all moving to taller displays, you're telling me we're going to use more, you know, horizontal real estate or whatever?
Is we got a lot of horizontal real estate, man. Like these double wide and triple wide monitors.
Here's the thing. So if you move the tabs to the side, you can get rid of the title bar. Right.
Right.
So you now have more space.
You save some vertical space.
There you go. You can also collapse the tab bar so that it's just a row of icons, and then you don't lose any horizontal space. So you can mouse over it. It pops out. You kind of get the best of both worlds in a way. So technically, I suppose, in a world in which you do have taller displays, if you have a single display and you have a browser there, you could have more space overall by using this feature. I can't stand it. So, and I have tried I want to like it. Like there's some kind of muscle memory thing with me where I go to the top of the window to see and use those tabs. And I even things like control tab, which switches between tabs.
Yeah.
I find visually or just mentally awkward for some reason when it's on the side. I don't know how to explain it.
I tend to binge blogs on Sundays.
Yeah.
In the afternoon, I'll go, it's time to do my .NET Rocks reading, right? And I've got a huge list of bookmarks and so forth. And I found that the bookmark manager in Brave is pretty great, that I can just fire to that and just right-click, open tab, right. Open 50, 60 tabs or so, and then just work your way through it.
Yeah.
Read one after the next, close them, make a note, shuffle it over,
whatever. There's this thing called RSS. I don't know if you've ever heard of it.
I'm listening.
Apple mangled it.
AI, the RSS is going to be the big thing.
Yeah.
No,
I use an RSS reader, subscribe to all my blogs, and I don't have to do tabs in my browser.
Somebody asked me, how do I keep my browser bookmarks or favorites up to date between browsers? You know, and I was like, what are you talking about? But the point is everyone
Vivaldi
works a different way.
Probably so, does that, I would guess.
Vivaldi probably
does so
do
many
that.
Crazy things.
There's a like Microsoft Edge, for example. I can't stand the way they handle history. It pops up. It's like a weird little floating panel thing. And it's like, what is this? I go into the menu. I go to the thing I want. I click it. I get back to the thing I lost. Like, that's it. I don't need like a whole UI for this. It's just a list, you know? But everyone works differently. I mean, I use RSS, and I have like a Momentum homepage replacement that I just have. Half a dozen or a dozen links and I leave my browsers. I have pinned tabs and a set of browser tabs that are just always open. But we all do, whatever. We all do stuff differently. It's just that the way I do it is right. So, and then we have, continuing the bad news. Last week we talked about HP falling off a cliff. This time, Dell is falling on top of them and hurting them further. So Dell, I've been complaining about this for a few weeks now. I guess every week one company does some weird quarterly report on some bizarre date scheme, but Dell is seeing the same problems as everyone else. So Dell, $578 million of net income, a drop of 46% year over year on revenues of almost $21 billion, a drop of 20%. Their PC business, the Client Solution Group, posted revenues of $12 billion, a drop of 23%. You recall, at EC, I believe the number was 27-29% drop in the same rough time period, although we're moving forward now. So it's kind of an overlap thing. But in Dell's case, Dell's kind of interesting. And this is weird because you would think Lenovo would be like this with ThinkPad, but they're not. The vast majority of their PC revenues are the business market, not consumers.
You know, I'm always surprised these guys don't just remind you of their 2019 numbers, like the pre-pandemic
right.
numbers.
Yeah.
Because it's back it's to that, like, right?
Well, and it's just, it's sort of that acknowledgement. Like in 2019, they're talking about, hey, revenues of $20 billion, and a 570 net.
Sure.
And in 2019, it was revenues of $24
billion. Right.
Right. Like, which I get, maybe that's the issue, is that if that number was lower, right. Then it's like, hey, we're back to
above
2019 numbers.
You have to wonder if they're worried about that being the case, that we kind of plateau at a point that is lower than pre-pandemic. I don't think anyone wants that. The thing that's most striking about the Dell results, honestly, because I just care about the PC stuff, is how little information there was. Like, it was just nothing. Just nothing. And that business is over half of their revenues. It's their biggest business. And there was no information about it.
But the COO did a good job of making happy noises about it. We executed well against a challenging economic background.
Oh, well, here's the thing. So actually, Dell beat expectations.
Oh, they're nice. Doing there great. You go. Yeah.
So this is most about setting low expectations.
That's the key. Fact, Apple always did
they
that.
They actually got in a little bit of trouble. So yes, I guess somebody broke their NDA on their numbers and published the results.
Can't sandbag
the
numbers.
Had to go live with it. Yeah. They had to halt trading.
Yeah.
And when they came back, their stock shot through the roof.
It worked.
So, yeah.
All right.
Good play.
Well, this episode of Windows Weekly brought to you by Cisco Meraki. Oh, you know that name. They're the experts in cloud-based networking for hybrid work. And man, hybrid work is happening. Whether your employees are working at home, at a cabin in the mountains, on a lounge chair at the beach, or even in the office, a cloud-managed network
is going to give them the same exceptional work experience no matter where they are. You really want that. You really do. I mean, it does, you know, otherwise, inconsistent results is bad. You may as well roll out the welcome mat, too, because hybrid work, whether you like it or not, is here to stay. It works best in the cloud. And by the way, hybrid work has perks for both employees and leaders. Your workers can move faster, deliver better results with a cloud-managed network, while leaders can automate distributed operations. They can build more sustainable workspaces. They can proactively protect the network. That's actually a big issue. Meraki commissioned an IDG MarketPulse research report, and it highlighted the top-tier opportunities in supporting hybrid work. I was kind of surprised to read this. Hybrid work is a priority for 78% of C-suite executives. They know they need to do this. And you know what? I think they want to drive collaboration forward. They, of course, need to stay on top of productivity and security. They understand the challenges. In fact, security is a big challenge. IDG raised the red flag about security, noting 48% of leaders report cybersecurity threats as a primary obstacle to improving workforce experiences and moving the workforce off-site in some cases. Always-on security monitoring, that's one of the things Meraki brings to the table. And it means your cloud-managed network is actually better. It's better. IT can use apps from Meraki's vast ecosystem of partners, turnkey solutions built to work seamlessly with the Meraki cloud for asset tracking. I mean, it's really a great platform. Location analytics. You can gather insight. This is very valuable to how when employees are in the office, how they use their workspaces. You can actually create a smart space where environmental sensors can track activity, you know, see where the hot spots are. That's really useful for staying on top of cleanliness. It's also great for hot desking because you know exactly what the usage patterns are. So you can allow employees to reserve workspaces, for instance, based on vacancy, employee profiles. Even in high security restricted environments, you can have them book in advance and then you can allow them only entry only in that time window. Time-based door access. Mobile device management, of course, is key these days, and you can integrate devices and systems so that IT can manage, update, and troubleshoot company-owned devices, even when the device and employee are at a remote location. All this is enabled by the Cisco Meraki Cloud Platform. It lets you turn any space into a place of productivity. It lets you empower your organization with the same exceptional experience no matter where they work. It's Meraki and the Cisco suite of technology. Learn how your organization can make hybrid work. Visit meraki.cisco.com/twit. M-E-R-A-K-I. You know Meraki. You know Cisco. meraki.cisco.com/twit. We thank them so much for their support of Windows Weekly. Back to the show. Okay, gentlemen, you've put it off long enough. Let's talk Spox. How do you pronounce that? Box? Box?
Box.
Box. Spox. Xbox. You have been going through, Paul, and I admire you, a real season of deprivation and renewal. How's it been? Oh, you're muted, sir. Unmute your Mikey phone.
Sorry. I've been trying to break my Call of Duty addiction. And one thing I've noticed about myself is that when I travel for work or for whatever, I don't miss playing video games. Like I could be gone for 3 weeks in Europe back when we were doing home swaps or in Mexico now. And I don't really ever think about playing video games, you know? And I've been playing video games my whole life, right? I'm one of the original generation. We had a Mattel and television when I was whatever, 11 years old or something. But I've always been into video games, right? When I started writing books, the guy who got me into writing was talking to me about how he would use this as kind of a way to reward himself. He got a chapter done in a book or something. He could play a little bit of Castle Wolfenstein 3D or whatever it was. And, whatever. So it's something I've done. I don't think that playing games has gotten in the way of writing. You can see what I do. It's all out there on the web. So whatever, but
sure, you can quit at any time. It's not
impact on your life in any
well,
way?
Well, I was hyper productive when we were in Mexico back in March. I got that book published. I thought I was just going to get like a tiny part of that done. And I was like, you know, I'm gonna see if I can keep this going.
Yeah, I often think that when I'm playing a game, like, what could I be doing with this hours?
Is this a memory?
Yeah, I always thought that Guitar Hero game. I thought if I put the same amount of time into actually learning the guitar, I'd probably be able to play it.
I don't know how weird this is for other people, but I've played. These multiplayer levels in Call of Duty so many times, they are real places in my brain. So wow. I know my way around Washington, D.C. and Paris and Boston.
Yeah.
And I know my way around these levels in the same way. And I don't know that that's healthy, right?
I got to the point with Valheim where I really felt like, you know, that was that Viking building game I was addicted to. I think I spent more than 600 hours in it over a period of a year. It was during COVID, and so, you know, it was my kind of quarantine. Yeah.
Well, listen, we all get a pass for that.
And I got to the point where I felt like it was actually my second life. Like, I had a life here in this plane and a life in Valhalla. And it was I had that probably the same epiphany that you did, Paul, that this is becoming.
I don't know which one was more repetitive, my real life or my fake life, you know?
And I wasn't doing it as a refuge. I was happy, but it was so fun.
Fun is an interesting word. So in my case, I think this is actually like an ADHD thing for me. Like I'd say, if I fail doing something, I can do it again and maybe succeed. And if I succeed at doing something, maybe I could succeed even better the next time. Like, it's like, I'm just going to do this thing over and over and over again. And different people will be in the game, so it's a slightly different situation. I don't know what it is. But anyway,
it's a variation on improving your time in running laps. Yes. And I know folks that fish like that.
That's right.
You know, where it's like I'm hunting this particular steelhead in this particular stream day after day after day. And like,
Right. So for us, we'd look at that and say, that sounds terribly boring. Just like my wife would look at the screen and be like, I don't know, why do you do this? Like, I don't know.
Yeah.
Why?
I had a friend who didn't feel like he had a good mountain bike ride if he didn't have to carry pieces of his bike home. That was a good day for
that's
him.
That's a little too far. Okay. But
a little intense. Yeah. Sometimes he was carrying a clavicle too, but you know, I got to do.
If I can get out of bed without throwing out my back, it's a good day.
Yeah. You progress.
So yeah, I came home. I was helped too, because when we came home, we had 1 week before we had to move, and that was horrific. And then I moved, and that was you don't just move and you're done. It took weeks, and so that helped, right? So I think that helped me get it through it. So I have played a few games. I've been playing games on the PC. I tell you, the cure for video games is to play Halo. That will solve your problem nicely.
Why?
Halo on the PC?
The new version is on the PC. Well, they're all on the PC now, thanks to Xbox Game Pass. But because it's not a great game. And with Call of Duty, I really, for whatever reason, whatever addiction it had, I wanted to do it. And with Halo, it was like I kind of had a struggle. Like I had to kind of force myself to do it. It's like this monotonous series. Like imagine you're on some ring world thing and it's like, oh, we have to go destroy these three towers. You got to do one at a time. And there's things that happen in between them. And like doing each one is so tedious that like you do the first one and you're like, oh, that's enough for today. I just can't. This is like work. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not entertaining.
You're at that point.
Yeah. So that helped. It actually helped. Yeah. It was also an interesting opportunity to go back and play some older games I hadn't played in a while. Again, thanks to Xbox Game Pass Ultimate, right? So, you know, Doom 3 is in there. That's amazing. Mm-hmm. Return to Castle, Wolfenstein. I played some of the newer Doom game, actually Minecraft Legends, which is new, Quake 2, you know, stuff like that. So it was kind of, it was just like, it became a little healthier. It's
sort of a rereading of old books too.
Yeah.
You know? There you go. I'll go explore that story again.
Yeah. Right. It's not, I've done this stuff enough that it doesn't, there's no surprise coming. Right. So it's just an entertaining thing I can do for a little while. I have played so little video games, though, honestly, in the past 3 months. It's kind of astonishing. I think this is the biggest break or gap, or whatever you want to call it. I mean, possibly since I was a child. It's amazing.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's been interesting. I have not plugged in my Xbox console once since March, I guess, 2nd probably was the date.
Wow. Paul.
Yeah, it's fine. I know. But it's fine. Like, it's good.
And fine.
Have you
I'm
been
fine.
More productive?
No.
Has your relationship with your family improved?
No, I can't stand those people.
So there is no benefit. Has your sleep improved? Your physical fitness?
Nope.
There's no benefit. Get back to your gaming.
When I was away, I got that book done, and that was like almost a manic period of productivity.
Yeah.
Like I said, I moved. I mean, there's a lot of that kind of stuff. But it doesn't matter. Like, it's fine. Like, I didn't cure cancer. You know, I don't mean to say like I did all this awesome stuff, but like,
you felt better.
Yeah. Yeah.
Did you?
Yeah, it feels better.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep.
Okay.
I feel like my relationship with Call of Duty was unhealthy.
Yeah. So always the question then is it actually stopping the interaction or is it the fact that you had control? Like the empowerment is I decided to do this. I did this. That's a win, regardless of what it may have been. It's like, I was looking at kicking my cocaine habit, but the hell with that. Call of Duty, right? I ditched that one instead.
Sure. I don't know what to say. I mean, I think it was, I mean, maybe I made it a little too easy. Before, and now it's
do the right thing. You put the thing in a box, right? Yeah. Like that's the way to go.
You know, by the way, very good technique. Move to Mexico.
There you go. That helps too.
And leave the Xbox home.
Right. Do you guys do you ever watch the show Yellowstone? Have you seen the show?
Love it. Watched every episode of 1923, 1883, the whole thing.
It's insane. So we're binging the original series. So I think we're in season 4.
Yeah.
It was just a scene where the patriarch, the Kevin Costner character, gets up in the morning. He just got back from getting shot. He's all hurt and stuff, and he wants to ride his horse, you know. And he was describing to some kid. He just said, he's like, you can just sit there and watch TV, I guess. I'm going to go do stuff. And he's like, I feel like if I don't go do something, that's when I die, you know, like a shark, you know. And I think sitting here playing video games is just like a really unhealthy way to spend time.
Sharking.
I celebrate this, Paul. I think this is great.
It's interesting.
I think video games, for certain people can become very addictive. Like any dopamine hit, you become focused on it.
Right. And I don't mean to say I won't play video games or I'm not going to blame. I haven't.
Not even you aren't playing video games.
I am. I'm not playing a lot for sure. But I mean, you know, like one thing we could talk about right now. So Redfall came out recently. It bombed, you know, and
bombed because it's terrible.
It bombed because it's terrible. It's absolutely true. And I know that because I played it. And the reason I played it is because I subscribed to Xbox Game Pass and I got to play, not for free, but as part of my subscription.
You already paid for it.
I streamed it. And it's freaking terrible. You know, it's a really bad game, and now I know, and I didn't have to go spend $70 on it or whatever.
Is this all by way of saying we're not going to do an Xbox segment anymore?
No, not at all. No, I think this is still very important. I'm still going to play games, you know, here and there, but I think it's just going to be less time from personally.
Just want to warn you, you might be tempted at some point to play a game in the browser called Universal Paperclips.
Okay.
It's about AI, so it's kind of timely.
I see. Oh, it's okay. It's in my wheelhouse. That's good. That's
good. You might enjoy it, but again,
my record time is 80 minutes.
That's right. I forgot. You're a Universal Paperclip genius.
First couple of times you play Universal Paperclip, you'll play it overnight.
That's right.
But if you start really working on the math around things, you can get your time down. Anything under 2 hours is good. 80 minutes just means I got lucky.
So, Paul, we've talked about this game before, but you've not played it yet.
No, I'm not.
Don't do it.
I think it is a great way to kind of... It's based on Nick Bostrom, who is problematic, I understand. Nick Bostrom was a Oxford philosopher's. One of his thought experiments, which is if you told an AI that its job was to make paper clips and didn't give it any constraints, eventually it would consume the entire universe just to make paper clips. And that's what this whole game is. And I think in some ways
I like thought consuming experiment. The universe on occasion.
But it's kind of fun to play. Yeah. It is apparently down right now, decisionproblem.com, I guess because everybody, as soon as I said this, there it is, said, let's play it again. It's one of those things you play, and then every once in a while, you just bring it up again.
Right.
And it like, starts by making just one paperclip. And then another. Another.
So far, it's not as exciting as Call of Duty. I mean, I don't know if the graphics get better on a computer or something.
No, they don't. No, this is it right here. Eventually, you will make enough money that you can buy an automated paperclip. You don't have to tap it forever.
Sure.
And then eventually AI gets in the picture and it gets a whole heck of a lot faster.
Can you get like a GoFundMe thing going to help buy
the
that?
Whole thing. It's great. Yeah.
Paul, do yourself a favor.
I'm going to buy an auto clipper. Look at that.
Use your fancy mouse to automate repeat click so you can just hold it down over make paperclip.
What I'll do is I'll learn JavaScript and then I'll use those skills to program this page to work better. Yeah,
clearly, we need to roll out DeepMind to play Universal Paperclip.
It is a genius game. It was created by a guy who actually teaches game design at a, I can't remember which university, NYU, I think. But I think you should play this. It will, in some ways, it will sanitize you.
It will suck.
There are no, you know, there's no Nazis or zombies or anything. It's just you.
Yeah, that's disappointing. But, you know, I'm open to the fact that there are games that don't have those things. Like, I get that, sort of theoretically. Yeah, it's okay.
Yeah, my reward game has always been Kerbal Space Program.
Yeah, that's a great
that's a game
too.
Where you can pick it up for an hour, work a mission, and then put it back down again and come back to that
and
mission
it's
later.
Similar because you're building, you know, it's one of those environmental things where you're creating stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I call it a gardening game, right? Yeah. Like you're essentially, except your garden is a space program.
Right. Are there adversaries? There's no attacks or bad guys.
Oh, no, just gravity.
Just gravity.
Gravity is
guy.
Your adversary.
Yeah. Yeah. Continuing on with the Xbox segment, which Richard and I have successfully derailed.
Completely.
I accept that challenge.
What else?
It's okay.
What else you got, Pauly?
So when the Xbox Series X and S launched 3 years ago, almost 3 years ago, one of the little controversial deals was Microsoft would support storage expansion, but only through proprietary cards. And at the onset, they announced that there was one partner, Seagate. And you could actually do USB storage, remember, too, but that only works with older games. If you want to play the newest games, you have to have either internal storage or this new kind of storage. They were kind of expensive, and it was only one partner, and it was kind of weird. And more were coming, and more never came. But now we actually have a second partner for this, Western Digital. They have, I think, two or three cards. There's a 500 gigabyte card for $89.99. And there is a, sorry, that's not true. It's $79.99. The Seagate version is $89.99. And then there's a 1 terabyte version for $149. So, and as Seagate also has a 2 terabyte version at $399, which is now less expensive at $279. So the prices are starting to come down. There's still only two companies, but at least there are two companies. And this is a particular problem for the Xbox Series S.
These are still ridiculously expensive. You can buy a 2 terabyte SSD for $120.
Yeah, I know. So this is one thing Sony did right. Sony, I mean, you have to meet some certain performance characteristics, et cetera, but Sony lets you put an M2 card into their console and expand it that way. So
that's so they one went thing. From a monopoly to a duopoly.
Right.
Here's your $10 back.
Yep. This is like Apple additional RAM pricing, basically. You know, it's like double what it should be, but at least it's there, is my point. So
call it progress.
I'll call it something. I don't know. and then Microsoft announced a new Minecraft game today. But the interesting thing about it is, or an update, I should say, the Trails and Tales update to Minecraft. With it, now Minecraft is available for Chromebooks for the first time. And
wow.
Yeah. You have to have a fairly recent
the Bedrock Chromebook. Edition of Minecraft.
Yeah.
Now, admittedly, this game is written in Java and it was supposed to run everywhere the whole time.
Yeah.
This is not the Java version. That's the difference.
This is not the Java version.
This is Microsoft's.
Oh, it had to run on Chrome OS. That's not going to run Java.
Right.
Right. Well, well, I don't know. I'm not really sure how this works. I mean, I assume this is like it's a native install. I know there's a Linux going on there. I assume that has something to do with it. You have to have pretty good.
That might be the workaround because you could on Chromebooks, you can run a Windows or a Linux subsystem effectively. Yeah.
So it's
a nuisance.
Probably that, it's only $20. It includes the Android version for free, so that's cool. So if you're in that ecosystem, There you go. So that's kind of interesting. We talked about Redfall already, and it's terrible. It's still terrible. It looks like it was written with Quake 2 graphics, which were impressive for the day and are no longer impressive 20 years later. So
yeah, Quake, it was impressive in 1998. Here's my question.
Here's a new game.
Is this an example to the UK CMA of, see, when we do exclusive titles, they fail anyway. So let's put the Blizzard.
Well, this is an early example of Microsoft butting into Sony, because when they went to this Bedrock edition, they started going cross-platform. So they were letting people on different platforms play together in Minecraft. And the only company that said no was Sony. Although they eventually bought it, but yeah, because that's, you know, that's how they are. They're terrible.
Okay.
And we also already talked about this, the wine-based toolkit that Apple has coming in the next version of macOS that will help games that were designed for Windows be either play or be ported more easily to the Mac.
Yeah, they're pitching it as a way to test your Windows game to see if you could port it. But I think it's interesting, because I think you maybe could just use it as an emulator and like Proton on Linux and play them.
I know in the Microsoft world, there are a lot of people who can't stand Apple for all kinds of good reasons, but listen, the hardware is incredible. Their M series chipsets are unbelievable.
Are the best.
Yeah. This is, it's very interesting. So, this is the holy grail, I think, the missing link or whatever you want to call it on the Apple platform. I thought it was a little goofy during the keynote that they had a Death Stranding demo. I know it's like the director's edition or whatever, but I literally just got that game for free through the Epic Game Store and Windows.
Good timing.
It's a 4-year-old game.
It's not exactly. Yeah.
They had Kojima on stage, Kojima-san, the designer. So that's, you know, big
on
deal.
Virtual stage, right? I mean, that
who knows
is
when
big
he
deal.
Was actually there.
But, yep. So that's cool. But again, I to me, it served to highlight how behind the Mac is more than make it look advanced. But whatever. This is perhaps a surmountable problem. We're going to find out, right? That this chipset could run DirectX 12 graphics on the SoC
in real time
without a dedicated GPU. Yeah, I mean, this is a powerful chipset. So
you said this in your article, and it's exactly the right message. The thing they should have shown is Diablo 4.
Yeah,
right. If they'd shown Diablo 4 running on a Mac, the world would have erupted. Like, that's a big deal.
And in all probability, Diablo 4 is not a very demanding.
I know. It seems like something that could run.
Totally well right. They could have done it, except, you know, Blizzard.
Well,
Blizzard,
I think it's the company that made it. I'm sure they would have if they could have, right? So anyway, it's interesting. It's worth noting if you're kind of holding off on the Mac because of this. Well, you should still hold off. It's going to be a little while. Well, but
and your next story is another reason to hold off. It's bad news for
Okay, is it? I mean, so this is the thing. So Amazon just announced they're killing the native app for Luna on Windows and Mac to focus on the web-based version of the app. And does that mean Luna's going to be going away soon? Is this the first little obvious chip there? I don't know. I mean, obviously, why would I know that? But I will say, Luna and Stadia, when it was a thing, both had the same advantages, which is they had this custom controller that worked directly with the service. It didn't go through the device necessarily. It could. And they had low latency, and it was good. And so now that Stadia is gone, Luna's kind of the one that works the best for this kind of thing. It would be sad if this went away. Amazon doesn't kill things haphazardly like Google does. I mean,
This looks like cost reduction. It's tough to maintain that software. And the other argument is the web app's good enough. Let's save some money.
Yes. Yeah, I'll be fine. If the web app's good enough, I'll be fine.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. So,
I mean, maybe that's really the bottom line at this point. And thanks to WASM, WebASM.
Well, we can have one client. This is the whole beginning discussion we had. It's like Apple wants native and Google and Microsoft will do native if you want it. But really, cross-platform is the way. And
WASM would work for everybody.
Right. And one of the major ways you do that is, web app.
But, you know, the CMA was protecting the burgeoning cloud gaming market. So
that's true. Well, it's sad so they didn't get there quick enough to save Luna, those slow-moving jerks.
Clearly.
Sony came out this past week and said, you know, cloud gaming is kind of tricky. It's almost like no one's
strange.
You know what people haven't addressed, and it may be the real reason for all of this, is the server time is expensive. I mean, they have to run pretty hefty GPUs in the cloud.
You're onto it, Leo.
That may be the real cost, right?
I think all these vendors are going through what they're spending on cloud right now and saying, like, are we making this back or not? You know, and it's true of the ChatGPT, the GPT-4 stuff. It's true of a whole bunch of services. I think the bean counters are in charge at the moment. They've been counting the beans, and you've been spending more money than you thought.
Yeah. Probably that combined with lower usage than they expected. And the thing is, you have to overbuild, right? So maybe spiky usage is really the problem, where it's low usage most of the time, but then Diablo 4 or something comes out and everybody wants to play it.
And you're loaded up.
And you have to have enough Xboxes in the cloud to support those people.
But this is the correlation with the PC market decline. We were post-pandemic, and people are playing fewer online games, full stop.
By the way, we're seeing that in podcasting too, incidentally.
Sure.
Spotify just laid off hundreds of podcast employees. Our audiences for all of our shows is down by 10-20%. I don't know what you're experiencing, Richard. You might be a little protected because you're offering something that's so specific to enterprise.
The sysadmins is the sysadmins, but I'm with you. The numbers are off a bit.
Yeah.
Maybe 10%.
And I think that's the same thing we're seeing across the board. It's the end of the end of the pandemic, the beginning of...
I also think the weather's getting nice.
Right. Weather's
and
nice.
People let it out.
And from a point of view of podcasting, but this is probably true also of gaming.
See, my, a lot my, more content my usage of this stuff has not changed. Well, I stopped playing video games.
Look at this guy. He's the source of the problem.
No, but that literally has nothing. The pandemic has nothing to do with it. My listening time or whatever on podcasts has not changed in the slightest. I still listen to those things the same times and places and lengths of time as I always did because I go to the gym most days. And when I'm driving the car, whatever it is, like that's my time.
That's
get ready in the morning and I'm shaving and stuff. I throw on a podcast. Like I'm a little confused at that stuff timing. Are people suddenly going back to work that I'm unaware of? I feel like, you know, you go to cities and these office buildings are all empty. So I feel like this stuff, I think podcasts are a better place than video games because video games, you're dedicated and have to do it. But podcasts are things that people can do in those.
Well, podcasts maybe as a category, but individual shows, including this show, might be suffering because, you know, I'm still listening to Windows Weekly, but not as much because there's all these other shows and I'm sampling other things. I think there's such an array of content out there right now and so many things to attract your attention that every kind of, you know, thing, content consumption, including video games, is fragmented more and probably suffering as a result. I don't know. I'm just thinking. The fact that you're not playing Call of Duty, you may say, well, I'm an outlier.
Well, this is something I did for me, right?
Like, I understand, but maybe you're not such an outlier in the sense that maybe there's other people thinking, you know, I really ought to cut back on this gaming. It was one thing for me to play 600 hours of Valheim in COVID. I haven't touched Valheim. Yeah, Every once in a while I fire it up and I go, and I play for a little bit and stop. I think times have changed. I haven't visited my Animal Crossing town in months.
Oh my God! It's gonna be like a nuclear war happening.
Oh, cobwebs and roaches. They're probably all dead.
Sure.
No, but I really think there is something.
You killed
going on.
The Tamagotchi.
Yes, my Tamagotchi's dead.
Right.
All right. Let's take a break, and then we have the back of the book. Wonderful back of the book coming up. I think a lot of good stuff for you. Paul Thurrott, Thurrott.com. Richard Campbell, RunAsRadio.com. We'll even find out what's coming up on Run As Radio. But first, a word from Melissa, our fine sponsor. Melissa, the address experts. They've been doing it longer than we've been doing this show. Let's put it that way. Since 1985. And now more than 10,000 people use Melissa for full spectrum data quality. They are, in fact, I would say, the leading global data quality identity verification and address management solutions provider. Big news for Melissa. Congratulations. Once again, G2 has named Melissa's Clean Suite and Data Quality Suite a leader in the 2023 Data Quality and Address Verification Spring Report. Also, Momentum Leader and High Performer. I mean, the awards just keep on coming across small business, mid-market, and enterprise segments.
Melissa has received recognitions as a good partner, easiest to do business with, easiest setup, highest user adoption, easiest admin. People love Melissa. Along with leader status, and this is important, Melissa also ranked high in the price category for their clean suite and data quality suite across many segments. And that is because they have been committed since 1985 on return on investment. They believe that data quality should never cost more than it saves. So it's always a net positive, right? It makes you more money than it costs. They continue to offer the best affordable solutions for data quality and address verification. There's a reason why the ROI is so good. Poor data quality can cost organizations an average of $15 million a year. And the longer that bad data stays in your system, the more it costs you. It can cost you more than just money. It can cost you a relationship with your client. You can lose sight of them, lose track of them, or you could do what one company did to me and send me four different copies of the same catalog to the same address and name. That's a waste of money for them, and it's annoying to me. Melissa eliminates waste and lost opportunities from incorrect mailings, improves customer satisfaction with seamless real-time identity verification tools. You probably have some compliance requirements for things like Know Your Customer. Melissa helps you with that. And their matching and deduplication tools help establish a single high-quality customer record, linking all your customer touch points for an ideal 360-degree view of each customer. Oh, and you'll like this. Melissa complies with the United States Postal Service's move update requirements, which means you're getting the most up-to-date address data by processing in the USPS's National Change of Address Database. But don't think it's just the U.S. Melissa operates and works in it's now 240 countries and territories across the world. They are globally the address leaders. Global intelligent solutions to help organizations unlock accurate data for a more compelling customer view. If I had to give you one sentence, that's it. That's the elevator pitch. Oh, one more thing I do have to say. Yes, you're sending your data to Melissa, whether it's through FTP or SaaS, whether you're using their API, their variety of different means, and it's on-prem even. But you should know that Melissa absolutely values that data and treats it like the gold that it is. They undergo independent security audits to reinforce their commitment to data security. They're SOC 2 compliant, HIPAA, GDPR compliant, so your data is absolutely secure and safe in the best possible hands. Make sure your customer contact data is up to date. Your customers are verified. Your customer records are rich and complete. Get started today with 1,000 records cleaned for free at melissa.com/twit. Melissa, M-E-L-I-S-S-A, melissa.com/twit. We thank them so much for their support of Windows Weekly. These guys have been with us for a long time and for a great product. We use it. You should too. Melissa.com/twit. Back oh the book. Mr. Paul Thurrott, you start us off, will you?
Yeah. So one of the persistent, sorry, I literally have smoke in my throat.
I like the ladylike way that you coughed.
That's all I can muster.
Do you have a lace handkerchief you can really breathe. Sleeve and you can just whip it anyway, out?
What was I talking about? So one of the enduring problems I've had with Google is that they don't offer as seamless a way to sign in as Microsoft does. One of the really neat things about a Microsoft account is you type in your username, hit enter, code goes to your phone, you never use your password. In fact, you can turn off passwords. It's nice. So Google's finally moving to passkeys. This is going to be a modern sign-in solution. They did it for their consumer accounts last month. And now they're starting to roll it out on Workspace, which is the paid accounts, right? I have a Google Workspace account. That's what Thurrott.com is. So I've been dying to do this. This is my primary account. And I don't have it on my account. I've done what I have to do in the admin console, but it's still not available. It's one of those things that it's rolling
out. Jarvis is going to be so disappointed because he really wants this. Yeah.
Maybe he has it.
Ask him.
It's starting. So it just started a day or two ago. I just checked while you were doing the ad. I really, really want this. So anyway, it's getting there. It's going to be a little more seamless.
How should I check? Just log out of my Workspace account and try logging back?
Well, first of all, who admins your Workspace account?
Oh, Russell. Okay.
So you should ask him about it. You should have gotten emails about it. They explained what you have to do in the admin console to enable this feature.
Okay. I'll talk to him.
And then you can go to us. Yeah, you can find out. So that's happening. It's not for me. It hasn't happened. Maybe it's happened for you. I don't know.
I'll ask.
The second tip I actually mentioned on a show probably a month or two ago. And then the thing I said, it was coming. It never came. And it is here now. And this is, speaking of things I've been checking again and again, not every single day over the past month or so, almost every single day. And Microsoft, as you probably know, offers downloadable ISOs. If you just type in or search download Windows 11 ISO, you'll get to the Microsoft page that offers that. You can download the ISO directly if that's what you want. Or you can download the, the media creation utility or media creation tool. And that will create, it will download the ISO and then blow it onto a USB key or a DB drive if you're living in the 1990s. And you can use that to install Windows 11, right?
So for the first time ever. Do this. We've always recommended this so that you can fix problems. You want a boot disk.
So usually, I should say not usually, forever, what Microsoft has done is when a new version of Windows comes out, like Windows 11 22H2, they update that page. So you get the new version of Windows 11 and then time goes by, right? And Windows 11 23H2 will come out sometime later this year and there'll be a new version of the ISO. But for the first time ever, well, the first time since Windows 8X or at least Windows 10, they've actually updated the ISO so that it includes everything that they've added to Windows 11 since 22H2 through, it's not moment three, but it's everything but right before moment three. So that update that put the check mark in Windows Update, where you can get updates really quick, that's the latest thing that's in there. So it's like an updated version of the installer. It literally just went, well, I don't know when it literally went live, but I literally noticed it just a couple of days ago, finally went live, at least for me. And I, in my article, I explain what to look for because there's a V2 in the name. If it says V1, that's the old version. That's the original 22H2 on the download file name. If it says V2, it's the new version. And so they finally did it. And I just updated all my install media and all that kind of stuff. And world, this is exciting.
You keep it around. So, yeah, really. You keep that around a boot disk with the latest ISO on it for
always. Yep.
For maintenance purposes, installation. You get a brand new
machine. So I have a. I have all kinds of reasons for this. So the big one for me is the laptop I use for screenshots. I need this to be as clean as possible. Ah. And so you have to go through this process where you update everything and you have to, you know, HP support, you have to update that stuff. There's update all the apps in the store. It's kind of a pain in the butt. So using Winget and the utilities I talked about a couple of weeks ago, I've kind of sped up part of that process. This will just get the whole thing. I can use this as the base install and it's just like less to do just to bring this machine up to date. So it's just a nice thing to have because Microsoft has been updating Windows 11 at such a clip.
Yeah.
It's kind of out of date all of a sudden.
Yeah. Yeah. Are there tools you can go into an ISO and clean it up, take out stuff? No, you really.
Yeah, there are.
Oh, okay.
I feel like I'm going to get to that. The book is still not done. Like the Windows 11 book, will never be done, honestly. But it keeps changing
moving target.
I feel like once it's done from like a content coverage perspective, one of the things I do want to do is go in and address these kinds of issues. Like here are some third-party utilities you can use to fix the Windows 11 star menu or whatever. And the thing you just mentioned, there's tools like Tiny 11 and others that let you really modify the base install ISO and install a smaller kind of cleaner version.
I'd love Windows 11. Clean ISO.
Yeah, there's some interest in that stuff too, sure. Yeah.
All right. All righty.
I'll get there when Windows 12 comes out.
Nice.
Now let's talk about the best 49 minutes and 23 seconds you can spend.
Wow.
It's a long show.
Radio.
Sarah Young is a cloud security advocate at Microsoft. Her first time on the show. She's an absolute live wire. Wow. And you wouldn't expect a security product to be quite this much fun to talk about. But we were really addressing the issue that a lot of folks have where, you know, post breach, when they've been attacked, you go back through various logs and you can see the evidence of the hack. You know, they typically take months from the initial breach to when an actual ransomware attack would be visible to the operators. And so this Sentinel is a SIEM tool, being security information and event management. It's really about consolidating all of the logging that's going on throughout your organization and through all these different tools to try and give you a view that a breach may be occurring. And Microsoft provides, you know, in the Azure and M365 space, a ton of tools like Defender for endpoints, Defender for identity, Defender for cloud. Like there's a lot of them, and each one of them has useful information in it, but none of it gives you an overall view. So really it's about bringing together all those sources so that you can A, take a baseline, say like, what does normal look like? And then have the tool help you to say, hey, this is abnormal. So maybe it's a place to look and perhaps to interrupt a breach in progress rather than to wait until the bombs have gone off.
Yes.
And that's, I think that's why we went as long as we did, is there was a lot of pieces about how you fit these bits together, where the processing makes sense. Sentinel is charged by the ingress source. So the more different places you're pulling data from, the more it's going to cost you. So there's a lot of pre-processing you can do to lower those costs. And there's good tooling around all of this. So it's worth taking the time and really exploring it. Nominally, you already own it, right? If you're operating in Azure, this is a product you have access to. It's really about how much you spend on it. So it's mostly for putting in some hours to help it help you understand what's going on.
Fresh off the podcast griddle, Run As Radio, episode 883.
Mm-hmm.
Run As Radio.
By the way, sorry, 215 AQI here today, right now.
Oh,
nice air.
Oh, don't go outside.
Yeah.
No. That's well above fatal. That's it's not
265
good.
265. And then
that's one under 100. Whoa.
Yeah, that's 200 is, yeah, people with respiratory problems need to stay in.
That's, yeah,
I don't think. And you shouldn't, and you
my
shouldn't
son, exercise. So my son is in Rochester. He sent one from early today, 319.
Nice.
319. Oh, I'm like, do you spontaneously implode if you walk
that's
outside?
A lot of
How
smoke.
Does that work?
Yeah.
So what we've done, you know, in the past, we've got air filters everywhere. And, you know, we seal up the place, run the HEPA filters, which suck the smoke out, and and just don't emerge. Holy cow.
I know. Yeah,
that's terrible. Crazy. That's really bad.
I mean, I long for the clean, fresh air of Mexico City, as I've said.
That's amazing.
By comparison. It's weird. Anyway,
let's,
I'm sorry.
You need a drink. So fortunately, sure we think we have someone here who can recommend.
You know, now that we've done the whiskey series, and I see they're beginning to be published on YouTube.
Yes,
I
we're putting them out. Up. Yep.
The first one's up, but there's still more to come. And I hope some of these others come in because...
Oh, they will all the story, come in, I promise, yeah.
I'm going to talk about one distillery today that is a Scottish distillery. It's Glenmorangie.
Love them.
Because I think now that you have that foundation, I can go poke on the details of what makes Glenmorangie such an unusual distillery, even in a land of unusual distilleries. I mean, starting with its location, it's far up to the north. Nominally, it's a Highland whiskey, but they're almost at the Orkneys. They're so far north. When I went up that way, you go to Inverness first, and then you can drive about a half hour north out of Inverness to get to the Dalmore, which is a lovely place. And I talked about their weird stills and, you know, some of the aspects of the Dalmore. The Glenmorangie is another 20 minutes further north, just past... It's the village of Tain, although officially it's called the Royal Burg of Tain on the Dornoch Firth. So that's a bay of water that faces into the North Sea.
That's incredible. The Royal Burg of Tain.
The Royal Burg.
The Dornoch North. I'm listening to a wonderful podcast series about the decline of civilizations. And he's talking right now about how the Romans just could never get into Scotland. They were just too vicious.
Well, this is, and you're literally talking about the area of the Picts. Yes, this is the Picts live.
Yes,
and it was the Romans that named the Picts, and then they built a wall.
Yes, like Hadrian's Wall.
That's Hadrian's it. Wall. That's as far as they're going
to
go.
They call it Pict, as you'll be glad to know, exactly the same etymology as picture, because of the war paint. These people, yeah, I think they painted themselves blue, as I remember.
That's the famous one. But the big evidence from the Picts is it's a sandstone part of the world. And so they carved a lot of stone. Ah. And they were into all that sort of the Celtic knots. All of that comes from the Picts.
Cool.
In fact, the logo of Glenmorangie is this a piece of a... an interlocking swirls from what's called the Cadbolle stone, which is more than 1,000 years old.
That is so cool.
The Picts predate the the Viking invasion. They appear to have been associated with the Celts overall. They do like the ziggurats, their standing stones, that sort of thing. Yeah. And that particular part of Scotland was a bit of an unruly part. So there's there's evidence of
as opposed to the nicer, cleaner parts of Scotland that were just, you know, civilized and whatnot.
So there is evidence of liquor being produced in that area going back to the Middle Ages, mostly in documentation about crime, right? Illegal with booze making in one form or another, and lots of records of that. The formal distillery comes in 1843 when a fellow by the name of William Matheson buys a farm and its adjacent brewery and wants to convert it to become a whiskey distillery. Now, he hasn't got a lot of money, so what he does is he buys two huge copper gin stills. Now, gin, in the traditional fashion, in the pot still fashion, is typically distilled from grain with the botanicals right in the pot. And but in modern fashions, even in that time in the 1800s, they were starting to do high distillation of gin. So distill the grain separately and then soak it in the botanicals. Now, this is at the period where the coffee still has been invented. The coffee, Andreas Coffee over in Ireland, had come up with this column still in the 1830s. And this is where you became much easier to make a 90% pure spirit, which was really good for gin. You do that, then you soak the botanicals in it, would pull the flavors out of it, then you cut it with water, gin. But Matheson has got that kind of money. So the reason he's able to buy these giant gin stills cheap is they are flipping over to column stills. So he's going to make these into whiskey stills. And they call this a feature, actually. These stills are enormous. And they still, well, they don't use the original ones anymore. They have made every still replacement still in the same form factor. They're over 5 meters tall. That's like 17 feet. These are massive machines. They call them the giraffes. And in fact, every year they celebrate World Giraffe Day. And World Giraffe Day, if you weren't aware, is June 21st. So, and that's the only thing they have to do with giraffes, per se. Part of the side effect of being in a sandstone area, all that carving, is that actually the water's quite hard there. And normally when you're doing distillation, you want very soft water. We like limestone, not sandstone. So in the early days of whiskey manufacturing in that part of the world, one of the tasks you did in the off times each year was you climbed inside these giant stills with a hammer and chisel and scraped the lime scale off of the stills. Of course, obviously, in modern times, they have water softening equipment, so they don't have that much problem anymore. Also, because it's a distillery that's been around that long, they have clear records of when they converted from direct heat to steam heating of the stills, the modifications they made to the coils and stills, you know, to decrease that risk of explosion by not having open flame where you're boiling off alcohol. Funny like that, but they were part of that revolution as part of James Watt's steam stills and so forth. And in fact, with Glenmorangie, they were the very first distillery to convert to steam back in 1887. By the end of World War II, the Matheson family was getting on in years, and so they sold the distillery to MacDonald and Muir. These folks had been buying barrels and bottling to sell into the U.S. for many, many years. They're part of that organization, still exists. They make the whiskey known as Highland Queen, fine old Scotch, which you still buy today, although it's made a totally different way today. They make it with blending of Tullibardine rather than being made from Glenmorangie. So MacDonald and Muir bought it because they were the largest buyer of Glenmorangie at the time, blending it into their own whiskeys. And they found that a good business. So they also at that time bought Glenmorangie and Ardbeg down in the Islay. But otherwise, the facility is not massive. They have 14 aging buildings or 10 dunnage buildings. Those are the dirt floor, racked by threes style building. That's their main aging facility. They also have 4 rack rooms where they actually go higher. And all 14 buildings literally are right along the ocean. So part of their aging effect is exposure to salt. The salt water is right there. It's, you know, maybe 50 yards away from where the buildings are. Through those early days, they mostly sold to the U.S. They'd done very well in the U.S. markets. And so when Prohibition came along, things were bad for them. Now, remember, this is still at a time when you primarily shipped whiskey by barrel rather than by bottle. And so once the barrel houses are full and you can't sell enough barrels, it makes no sense to run the stills anymore. And so in 1931, they actually shut down. They mothballed the facility until Prohibition ended in 1936. They didn't know how long they would mothball, that's what they did. But the side effect of that, of course, is they got 5 years worth of aging in. So they were basically able to go ripping straight into business, except then, you know, a couple of years later, Hitler invaded Poland and everything got complicated. And so now there were shortages of barley. So really, they didn't get into full swing again until 1948, where they were finally producing more whiskey than they were in the 1920s. They were very much a blending whiskey maker. That was their business. Being owned by McDonald and Muir was part of that. So they didn't worry about making single malts until the 1970s, when single malts became hipper. And so then they went down, starting to make what they call the Signet line, and tried a few different experiments that went fairly well for them.
I have to say, I have a soft spot for Glenmorangie. My first whiskey that I tasted that wasn't kind of classic was their Portwood aged Glenmorangie, and it was amazing. I was in a movie theater, and one of my buddies handed me a flask, and I said, "What's this?" He said, "Portwood aged, baby."
Yeah,
so good.
Good stuff. Yeah. No two ways about it.
Yeah.
They had one of the very first, the earliest tours that I know of that anywhere from the 1990s was Glenfiddich, but Glenmorangie had theirs in 1994. So they're right from the beginning as well.
That's probably about when that happened to me.
In 2004, the McDonald and Muir sold Glenmorangie and Ardbeg and Glenmorangie to LVMH. That's Louis Vuitton Moët Hennessy.
They own it all, baby. Yep.
They own quite a bit in conjunction with Diageo. And that's really when Glenmorangie, it's LVMH, so they're going to pivot towards sort of luxury brands. That's their shtick. And they became a bit of a laughing stock inside of the whiskey industry as a whole, because one of the things that happens when you're involved with Moët and Hennessy is you have access to a lot of weird casks. And so they got big on doing aging in wine casks and cognacs and so forth. So they made all kinds of interesting whiskeys that way. But in the meantime, they'd also made a deal to buy a lot of American bourbon casks. And in the 80s, bourbon wasn't selling that well. And so they actually signed agreements with both Jack Daniel's and Heaven Hills, which is in Bardstown, Southern Kentucky, that they basically wanted exclusive rights to all the barrels. This agreement's changed since then, but they pretty much age everything in American bourbon, at least initially. And it's because of this agreement to buy tremendous numbers of bourbon casks. So they're kind of known as the wood wizards. Like they experiment with way more wood, different types, than most whiskey distilleries do. Their core range, this is probably the one you encountered, starts with what they call the original 10. So this is a pretty straight up bourbon aged whiskey from that barrel agreement that they've made with Heaven Hills and Jack to just age 10 years in bourbon. They again, their distillations are very, because their lye arms are so long, the stills are so big, they have a lot of reflux, so sulfurs are largely pulled out. There's a lot of copper involved there. So you kind of get a light, very mild bourbon or a whiskey that then is aged in these bourbon casks for 10 years. So it picks up a lot of bourbon character. And some folks complain that it's a bit harsh that way. But then they did these core variations. So after you spent 10 years in bourbon, if you're happy with it, you put it in a bottle and call it original 10. If you're not, then you put it into other barrels. And so Glenmorangie La Santa has that 10 years in bourbon, but then they put 2 years in sherry casks and then bottle it. And the Quinta Rubin is 10 years in bourbon and then 4 years in port barrels. And then the fourth of what they call the core ranges is one they call Nectar Dior, or, you know, gold nectar, which is 10 years in bourbon and then 2 years in Sauternes casks. So that is a white dessert wine.
Very sweet and delicious. Yeah.
Yes. I don't mind Sauternes. I find the whiskey a bit odd.
Is it sweet?
It comes up a little sweeter. It has some funny notes in it. It's kind of perfumey. Not what I generally look for in a whiskey, but some folks like it. So those are the most common. Those are generally the ones you're going to find. They have another range called the Prestige range where they're doing much more traditional whiskey aging, again, almost exclusively in bourbon casks, but that's your 18, your 24, your 25s and 30s, pricey, hard to find. That's the Prestige range.
Huh.
And this is, again, the effects of LVMH. They've made these things they call private editions. They've only done 10 versions of this. The last one was in 2019, which they called Alta, which is Celtic for wild, because they used a wild yeast, and they actually used Cadbull barley. So that is barley from the region of the north of Scotland, which is not generally good barley growing territory. It's very odd and but unique, and that's what people like.
These companies are experimenting, and it's
and Glenmorangie more than anybody. The latest set of stills and washbacks they build, they've spent a lot more money on them because they put in a lot of cooling and temperature controls because they're going to experiment further. And so they're sort of arming themselves with an experimental laboratory. Side effect of LVMH, they have this thing they call the Legend Collection. You will see the Legend Collection in airport duty-free. So they've literally made a set of whiskeys designed to be sold in duty-free, so they're found nowhere else. And mostly they are bourbon and then different kinds of wine caskings. And all of them I find somewhat suspect just because wine's alcohol level so much lower. The texture inside of the barrels are different. You can't put a solvent in there for very long and not really pull some harsh flavors out. But so they're tricky ones to buy. But there's a reason they sell them in airports. People will pay too much there.
Never buy your whiskey in an airport.
Well, especially when it's whiskeys that are made specifically for airports.
Airport whiskey.
You will find they almost never have an age on them because they tend to be very young.
And they say on the label, duty free.
That's it. That's literally how they're built.
It's like buying sushi in a supermarket.
Buying sushi in the gas station, right? So knowing you like a cask strength.
I do. I love cask strength, yeah.
So there are relatively few cask strengths in Glenmorangie, but one edition comes from their limited range. It's called a star. Again, another Celtic word for journey.
Yeah.
And that's a cask strength, about 52%. The last time they made it was 2017. The time it was $100. Today, if you can find one, it's about $200. A purely aged in bourbon cask.
Yikes. That is not a recommendation this week, though.
No. The one I pulled up is the one I like the most, which is the Quinta Rubin 14. $55. It spent 10 years in bourbon, 4 years in port. They originally, a few years ago, made a 12-year-old that I just don't think was as good. The 14-year-old is better. 46 ABV, which is kind of the magic number for very drinkable whiskeys. This is a winner. Like, you can't go wrong, right? Yeah. Like, you'll be this is probably what your friend had you taste.
Yeah.
For exactly that reason. It drinks super nice.
It was so long ago. It was so long ago. I wonder if it was before the LVMH acquisition. That was in 94, you say?
That was 2004.
Yeah, I feel like this was prior to that.
Yeah, so it might have been one of the others. But they,
I remember is Portwood aged was the thing that was new to me. And boy, it was delicious. But this, I think this might bring back fond memories. I'm going to try it. Yeah.
Yeah, I get nothing bad to say about the Quinta Rubin. It's the one of all of the Glenmorangies, it's the one I pick first just because it won't make you sad. It's a good drink.
Won't make you sad. It's a pretty bottle.
Yeah, this is the rebranding. This is, again, an LVMH thing. There's a more traditional bottle styling, but you see the little waspy waste on it, the flare at the top, and the new text. They've kept the Carbol logo, which is good. Oh, yeah, no giraffes in sight. I'm happy about that.
Yeah.
But yeah, very modern.
So none of their older styles are still around, huh?
All of them are tricky to find. You won't find them in a BevMo or a Total Wines.
Yeah.
You can find them in specialty shops. And there are definitely premiums. I think their 25 goes for $5,000 if you can find it.
Wow.
So,
wow.
They just, you definitely have to, the one you just pulled up, the 18, that's the classic Glenmorangie look.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
With the text on the top, you know, the age.
Yeah. I think closer to what I had.
That's very much a classic, but that 18 is a straight bourbon casking.
Okay.
They didn't do anything else with it, which is their usual.
Yeah. Yeah. I could taste the port. I was so surprised. It was like, what the heck?
What have you done to my whiskey? Glenmorangie, though, still pretty good, even though they've been sold to the luxury brand.
That's what they've had 20 years of that. If things were going badly,
yeah, I guess
they wouldn't be doing as well as they are. Right. Yeah, but they are. You know, the trick with any of these is to know what do you like? Well, you know, I tend to be more of a traditionalist, and they make a line that appeals to traditionalists.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. If you want to go exclusive, they make a line exclusive. If you're buying stuff in airports, they make a line for that.
Just for you. So, they make a line just for you.
They have a choice there. And that's, you know, that's good branding, really.
Yeah, the good news is you don't have to paint yourself blue to try it. You can just.
No, you really don't.
Go to your BevMo. The Quinta Ruben, 14 years old. They have a link on their website to Reserve Bar. I don't know if that's UK only, but. Yeah, maybe
I found it in BevMo for $55.
Nice.
And they'll deliver.
Nice.
So, you know, you can get it in the US at least.
I like BevMo.
My nice liquor stores here in BC have it.
Yeah.
And so it's often on my shelf.
Yeah. The closest I can get it is Prospect Chillicoot, California. I don't even know.
Chillicoot.
I have no idea where they're talking about.
That sounds like a Pennsylvania place.
Project Chillicoot. Prospect Chillicoot. Or Palm Point Drive, South Fernandina Beach. I don't know where these places are. but I could go there and get it. Maybe I'll go to BevMo. That's a little easier. Paul, Therot, Therot.com, LeanPub.com for the field guide to Windows 11, which includes Windows 10, and his newest Windows Everywhere. Really good reading. You can also, of course, go to his website, Therot.com, and subscribe to the premium edition and get a lot more great articles along that line. Always a pleasure, Paul. I saw that you said it's now, what is it, 358?
382.
You know, only it goes to 500.
I know.
I was in Beijing when it hit 800. That was not a good day. The paint was peeling off the taxi cab. It was,
yeah, I can feel it in my throat. It's not great.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, and get the animals in. Don't let them outside. This is bad for them.
We're 76 up on the roof here.
I bet they're not wearing masks.
76 is a little more normal.
Yeah, 76 is high for around here. We're usually under 10.
Fresh air.
Mexico City's probably close to that right now.
Yeah. Well, stay safe, Paul. We appreciate it. Of course, Mr. Richard Campbell is at runasradio.com. You can hear all his stuff there. And you got a conference coming up in a few months, I think. Yes.
Yeah, December, first week of December in Orlando.
All right.
And we'll be advertising that shortly.
Good. We'll talk about it when it happens. We do Windows Weekly every Wednesday around 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern Time, 1800 UTC. That's when we record it. You don't have to be here for that. But if you want to, there is a live stream at live.twit.tv, audio or video. The one advantage of watching live is you can chat with us live. IRC.twit.tv is open to all. There's also a Discord for our Club Twit members, kind of the Stadium Club up above. If you want to join us there, $7 a month. That's a lot cheaper than the Stadium Club, let me tell you. And you get ad-free versions of all the shows. You get shows we don't put out anywhere. That list is growing. Hands-on Windows with Paul Therot's just one of them. You also get access to a great social network, the Club Twit Discord, which is full of fabulous people. If you want to join the club, we'd love to have you. It makes a huge difference to our bottom line. It keeps people employed. It keeps the lights on. twit.tv/clubtwit. We always offer on-demand versions of the show after the fact, ad-supported, so anybody can get them at twit.tv/ww. There is also a YouTube feed dedicated to Windows Weekly, and of course, the best way to get it would be subscribe in your favorite podcast client. Club members get a special URL that's dedicated to them for the ad-free feed. Everybody else, just go to twit.tv/ww, and you'll see links to the major podcast clients, but also an RSS link, or search in your podcast client for Windows Weekly and subscribe. That's the best way to get it, so you don't have to even think about it. It's just there for you. Thank you, everybody. Stay safe, Paul. Don't breathe if you can help it. And we'll see you next time on Windows Weekly. Bye-bye.
It's midweek, and you really want to know even more about the world of technology. So you should check out Tech News Weekly, the show where we talk to and about the people making and breaking the tech news.
It's the biggest news. We talk with the people writing the stories that you're probably reading. We also talk between ourselves about the stories that are getting us even more excited about tech news this week.
So if you're excited, well, then join us. Head to twit.tv/TNW to subscribe.